want to convene the committee. Welcome to the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. It's a little, is the audio working? We hope everybody found it. We had to switch rooms because we're all under deadlines here and trying to get our bills heard. So this is our last day for this committee for hearing bills. And so I'm just going to go over the schedule first. Today we will hear four bills between now and 5:30. So I'd like to get through all of them by 5:30. Then we will recess from 5:30 to 6 o'clock for the committee members. There's going to be pizza in room 546. Then we will come back and convene, and we will meet until we finish our bills. Then we will come back, on Tuesday, we will release our bill. So for all of you that are in the audience that are interested, we'll be releasing our bill Tuesday to the public. We will be asking for some public testimony at that time. If you're ready, you can tell us what you think about the bill. But we'll also mostly be looking for that Thursday to take public testimony. And I know that's when kind of everybody else will be looking at the bill and talking about, you know, we want to hear what you like and what you don't like and all those types of things. And realize that we are under a lot of financial constraints here at the legislature. So I don't think anybody's going to be surprised that they're not going to get everything they want. If you did think you were going to get everything you want, I hate to burst your bubble, but I'm just giving you a big heads up. probably not going to happen. But we're going to try to do good investments in a systematic way that will help move the early childhood programs and kids ahead. So that is our goal. We don't have the author here quite yet, but we'll start, I would think, as I know the testifiers, we're on House File 894. You'd like to start talking about Head Start, Representative Graffalo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the scheduling, would amendments be taken up on Thursday then?
Yes, we also have amendments. So that's the whole thing, is if there's a lot of amendments, then we can't do as much public testimony. But if there isn't many amendments, then we could have more public testimony.
Is that it?
Madam Chair, would the deadline for submission of amendments then would be Wednesday afternoon?
Yes. Representative Graffalo, we do have a 24-hour rule in this committee, so it would be, Wednesday at 4 o'clock.
And, Madam Chair, would members of the minority have, should the majority be submitting any amendments, would the members of the minority have access to those amendments 24 hours in advance?
Yes, Representative Graffalo, we need to work that out, but yes. Obviously, at times we might need to do some amendments, the majority members, and it depends on, you know, hopefully we can get our bill good and sound and together by Tuesday, but as you know, sometimes things happen and we might need to have a few amendments and we'd make those available. We'll let you know when and where. I guess I could let you know on Tuesday.
No worries.
Any other questions about the process? Well, thank you. And I know some of you can't stay for tonight, and some of you are having lots of scheduling conflicts, and some of you have bills up in other committees right now, so we appreciate you being here in this very cozy setting. We feel like we're all in so much of a smaller room. With that, if you want to go ahead and talk about the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to introduce the Head Start bill for Head Start funding and some language changes, House File 894. And I'd like to introduce a parent to speak to the bill at first. Her name is Tammy Alphahead.
And to the testifiers, I need to move the bill. So the chair moves House File 894, be included for possible inclusion into the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, my name is Tammy Alphahead, and I am from Fridley. And thank you for your time. I would like to tell you a little bit about how Head Start has not only changed the lives of my children, but also changed my life. I'm very nervous, so bear with me.
We're friendly.
In 2002, we moved here with nothing and knew no one. We came with what we could fit in our cars and came on our way with a chance for a better opportunity here. When we got here, my mental health was not doing really well, and I was looking for some way to not only get my son help because his hearing was not well, he couldn't hear, so nothing that came out of his mouth you could understand. So we came across the Head Start program. We were referred from Anoka County Human Services. They accepted us right away based on we had no income, and also because of my mental health status, they also gave him a full-time, full-day program so that I was able to pursue my mental health so that I could be a better mom. We were involved with Head Start for 2 years. I then, for the first time, I struggled with a panic and anxiety disorder, which makes me unable to not only go out of my house, but to talk to people. I registered with the self-assessment, which is the team that looks at the Head Start program and kind of evaluates to see how well it's doing. It was the first time I had ever been in a setting like that. I not only participated, but when it did come time for me to give my speech, I was so nervous I couldn't speak. So somebody else had to take my place for me. With the help of Head Start, they've given me the training and the options to take a leadership role and to change and be a real advocate for my children. Now, this year, I am currently the chairperson for Anoka Washington Head Start for Policy Council, and I'm here talking before you now. So thank you so much. And I hope other families get the opportunity to use Head Start. Thank you.
Thank you for testimony, and obviously you've come a long way, so I'm glad you're here with us today. Representative Dabney, we've moved your bill, and I think you have an amendment as well. H-O-894-A-2. You'd like us to move that?
If you would, please, Madam Chair.
The Chair moves H-O-894-A-2 to House File 894. Representative Dabney, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Yes. Madam Chair, members, those of you who are familiar with the Head Start program know that it is not that it doesn't try to reach just one group of children, that the children of the state are not uniform, that there are target populations that are particularly at risk that have unique characteristics. And one of the strengths of the Head Start program is their ability, when we allow them the flexibility, to reach to specific target populations and meet those needs in innovative ways. This simply mandates and allows programs to develop those innovations such that they can reach those populations and be more effective for at-risk children.
Thank you. The chair moves House Amendment H-O-894-A-2. Is there any discussion? Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Dabney, do you have any further testimony?
Madam Chair and members, I'm bringing forward this bill simply because we know that Head Start works. We know that it's got a track record of proven, researched, and certain positive impact on at-risk children. And as the testifier discussed, it looks at the whole child, not merely the academic needs of the child, but the academic, the social, the medical, and other needs of the child. So just the little kid's academic needs aren't what walk in the door each morning. The whole child walks in, and they bring their family with them. And the connection that Head Start builds with the families is yet another positive dimension. I would urge the committee, as you move forward constructing your omnibus bill, that you look at what works for children, and Head Start clearly is what works for children in Minnesota.
I think that Gail Kelly still is going to testify. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association. To cover a lot of ground quickly, I had prepared a PowerPoint, but this room isn't avail us to that opportunity. So if you look in your packets, you'll see my handouts, and I will try my very best to move them without a computer. But I will say that I'll have to put on my glasses, so I apologize about that. I think this committee has to struggle with some really important issues. First, the critical issue of closing the achievement gap, addressing what we've seen in recent releases from the census data, an expanding gap of more Minnesotans in deep poverty, preparing children, particularly those for a very competitive global market in the future, And then you obviously have to allocate scarce resources, as the committee chair has already said. So when this challenge was put forward to the Early Childhood Caucus at the beginning of the session, the university professor Arthur Reynolds suggested to the caucus that they should consider Head Start for their investments. And I'm here to talk about Head Start as a solution. And I'll be very clear, and I just want to talk about four main points. First of all, I want to talk about Head Start as Minnesota's targeting to Minnesota's most unprepared family. I also want to talk a little bit about our evidence-based approaches and standards. I want to talk about its proven track record, because Dr. Ephraim brought up the area of research, and I want to make sure that we are talking about the most recent research and have some evidence. And finally, I want to talk about its statewide infrastructure and how it contributes daily to your local economies, that I think is very important to you as legislators. First, the issue of Head Start's priority. The first priority for Head Start is serving families most at risk. Our eligibility criteria require that we do that. Not only do we serve 90% of our families who are at or below the poverty level, we also serve 10% of our families with a diagnosed disability. You already know that there is a waiting list, and there are more people that are eligible for Head Start that get served. Every child who comes up into Head Start has to be the most at risk, the most eligible. So we are always serving the children that are most in need of the program services. In my graph, I showed you that the Head Start eligibility is far below eligibility for any other child poverty program that you have here, or we have here in Minnesota, below food stamps, below free lunch, below Medicaid and WIC. Its eligibility is at 100% of poverty. My next graph showed the fact that Minnesota's poverty population has grown. In 2000, the number of children under 5 who were eligible for this program were 34,000. At the newest estimates, the 2005 estimates, that's grown to 41,000. That's a 21% increase in the rate of poverty for children in Minnesota, or for this group in Minnesota. Right now, we serve about 34% of that eligible group of children under 5 with our state and federal funding. Just so you have an understanding of what I mean when I say we are serving the most at risk, the characteristics of the 15,000 families and 17,000 with 17,000 children that we serve, 52% of them are racially diverse. 28% speak a primary language at home other than English. 18% had a diagnosed disability, and you'll see that's much higher than the 10% we're required to serve. We serve almost double the amount of children with a diagnosed disability. And 5% of the families we served were homeless last year. Again, my second point, Head Start's approach. The reason I think Dr. Reynolds suggested Head Start as an investment is that Head Start has what is considered the highest quality in terms of standards for any program that you currently fund here in Minnesota. We are required to serve, to improve families' lives, considering the whole family. And that's a term that's often used when we talk about comprehensive services. We look not only at the educational needs of children, but we consider the whole family in the context, the whole child in the context of the family. So we offer health connections, nutrition connections, social service connections, and most critically, parent involvement. We have 1,700 performance standards. Many of our Head Start directors can cite chapter and verse, number and code on those performance standards. They don't dictate a program. The design of the program is developed by community needs, but they do ensure the quality of the program. Other quality factors I think you want to make sure that you consider when you think about this is the evidence-based techniques of a research-based curriculum, assessment tools, compensatory learning and early literacy, language, and social-emotional development, and the highest of accountability standards. We're monitored by our state monitors on an annual basis and by the federal government in a triannual review. And it's a very rigorous process in terms of making sure that those standards are upheld. I want to say also our approach is driven by parent involvement. And I think that's so key when we're talking about a program that's about empowerment. We have a shared governance structure. So a nonprofit agency that runs Head Start has a legal board And they have a parent policy council, and that's what Tammy is the chair of. Parent policy council that's 51% parents that are currently enrolled. And right now, as the federal government is talking about reauthorization of Head Start, this has been a critical issue, maintaining the parent governance, the shared decision-making. They also have, in addition to the policy, overall policy council, they also have parent committees on the local level that are actively involved in making the decisions about how the programs run, about budgets, about allocations, about everything that happens in the Head Start program. So I'll move quickly to my third point about proven results. I wish I had my PowerPoint. I feel a little bit more when I'm talking about research. But I think we were challenged to suggest to you what were our short-term and long-term results. And I think that another testifier had challenged those results. I want to be very clear. There are a tremendous amount of studies that were done in Head Start. It's obviously the oldest early childhood program our nation has. One of the things that we found out about the research is just as we've learned about child development, so we've learned about how to research early childhood programs. And really the best controlled studies that we have right now suggest that there are powerful short-term and long-term results from Head Start. I'm going to just cite a couple of them quickly. A comparison of school readiness done in the Journal of Students Placed at Risk in 2003 showed that it was funded by the Health and Human Services that children attending Southeastern Head Start program compared to the waiting list had positive growth. They modeled growth curves for children. And they showed they had positive gains in vocabulary, phonemic awareness, social functioning, and health. Similarly, a study that's happening right now in California, San Bernardino County, has shown very positive results, both short-term. They showed that Head Start graduates in kindergarten had higher grades in numeracy, language, literacy, social conduct, and physical development, and were absent 4.5 days fewer than our non-Head Start peers. That same study is a longitudinal study that's showing powerful social returns of, for every dollar invested, $9 return for investments in Head Start. And they're projecting those costs into gains in earned income, employment, family stability, and decreased welfare. On the long-term benefits, because that seemed to be so important for our community, again, one of the things they found that if you look back over the reliable studies that were done since Head Start was incepted, one of the difficulties people have is designing a study that has a large enough control group that doesn't, through attrition because of dropouts and special ed, is able to show long-term results. Reviewing those results and looking, pooling reliable studies, we have been able to show that Head Start can have positive graduation rate, higher graduation rates, lower crime rates, and higher earnings on the long term. And those studies have also been supported by the work of Janet Curry, who's also looked at sibling-to-sibling differences. Finally, this is an interesting study, I think, that might be interesting. Look retrospectively over all the when Head Start was incepted and looked at counties that had Head Start versus counties that didn't have Head Start. And they actually see a large drop in mortality rates for children 5 to 9 that can only be attributed by the presence of Head Start in their communities, as well as schooling changes. But let's just look at Minnesota. Every one of the programs in your local community, you can go into their program and look at child outcomes. And as my PowerPoint would show, children make significant progress from fall, winter to spring in terms of language development, literacy development, social functioning. And I don't have to tell you, you've heard it from every group that comes in, the kindergarten teachers love it when they know a child has been in Head Start. Finally, I think I also would like to say that we have many partnerships with Early Reading Corps and with WordsWorks. I think the chair is going to be putting together some different legislation on those that show positive impacts for involvement in those programs. Before I close, I do want to say the contributions to your local economy. There are direct savings related to your the investments, the $83 million federal dollars that come into community for Head Start. Those savings are in your local district special ed, your public health, your criminal justice system, and your family support system. Head Start is the place to refer families that need services in these areas, and we have great partnerships on our county and community level. As well as all those $83 million of federal dollars go back into job creation in your local communities. They go back into buying food, gas, supplies, services in your local communities, as well as in facility development and infrastructure in communities all over Minnesota. So we're here to ask you to allow us to expand access, to allow us to use our funds to increase the intensity and duration of our services by expanding early Head Start and expanding the hours and days of service, and to leverage more full-day services. And finally, we're here to ask you to allow us this opportunity for innovation so we can address the special needs of our immigrant populations, homeless populations, and children with disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a question. I want to ask a question of Representative Dabney, and then we have a question from Representative Wardlow. In your bill, you have $19 million per year. Can you tell us what the funding is right now and how much of an increase is this, and how does that relate? We always hear about the 2003 figures.
Madam Chair, I can't reference the 2003 figures off the top of my head, but what I am proposing here is essentially a doubling of state commitments to its highest poverty, youngest children.
Ms. Adrians, do you know the 2003 figure for Head Start?
Madam Chair, members. I believe the number for funding for 2002 and 03 for that biennium was about $36.75
million. For the biennium?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And then the 20% you're proposing would be as part of this, so taking 20% of your 38, many new allocation. Okay. Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dabney, it looks to me like we might be $200,000 biannually under what's in the governor's proposal. Am I reading that right?
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, great question. No, if you look on line 19, you'll see that this appropriation is in addition to the agency's base.
Okay.
So I'm roughly $38 million above, if you're counting.
Representative Horner?
I'm kind of disappointed now. No. But I'm not surprised.
Thank you. I'm not sure I caught that either. So I think that makes it a little more clear. Any other questions? Representative Eastland?
Yeah, and maybe you said this. I came in late, so I apologize. But did you talk about what this is going to give you the ability to do significantly more? Did you talk about what that means in terms of numbers and in terms of state geography in regional areas that don't currently have good access to Head Start?
I'll ask
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, I'll ask Ms. Kelly from the Head Start Association to speak to that.
Kelly?
The estimate I would give for the expansion would be right currently we serve around 2,300 children with this allocation. We would expand to around 4,500. The reason it isn't totally double, as you see the allocation is double, is that we would hope to serve more early Head Start children with that that allocation, and their cost per child is higher than that of Head Start. As far as distribution, this would serve children all over the state. Which cover all communities, and there's a Head Start program in every community.
Representative Mornes?
Madam Chair, I just have one other question. What's the amount of federal dollars that flow in the Head Start?
Should we ask Ms. Adrians to know, or Ms. Kelly?
Yeah.
Kelly?
Yeah, the allocation in 2006 was $83.3 million. We are still waiting on the 07 number because, as you know, the continuing resolution just was adopted not too long ago, and there was an increase for Head Start, a $1.3 million increase for the nation as a whole, but we don't know what that number will be yet for 2007.
Can you remind us, it's based on poverty, the formula, so the, how that's distributed, and I know you went over a little bit, but then also, how is it distributed, and then waiting lists, how many kids are on waiting lists across the state?
Do you want to know how the state appropriation is distributed, or the federal appropriation?
It is different, right?
Yeah, considerably. That
would be helpful.
To be honest, I cannot. Representative Sable used to say to us that it's so complicated nobody could understand how the appropriation is made. For it is based on your poverty rate, and Minnesota has one of the lowest poverty rates of states. So we are certainly. Representative Sable used to say, "I don't know if we're getting our fair share," but. Anyway, that was I can't decipher that. The allocation on the state funds is based 50% on unmet need or poverty, the number of kids that are unserved in a community, and 50% on the agency's federal share. That's that strategy was developed to encourage local grantees to go out and write as many grants as they possibly could to continually increase their federal share. And that's a really great competitive way to keep our programs actively seeking federal funds.
And what about the waiting lists?
Waiting lists vary across service areas. We have programs here today in Rochester that has a waiting list of 166 children. Pica has hundreds of children on their waiting list. Most communities have children ready to roll anytime a slot is open, and we continually refill places in Head Start.
And then I'm going to ask a question, then Representative Norris. So I do have to ask, are there unfilled slots?
Last year's, Michelle Weber's in the room, last year's program information report said that Minnesota was 100% full, and that was over a 3-month period of data collection. There may be programs, 100% means that they were full enrollment last year.
The average for the state.
The average for the state.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kelly, is that?
Yeah.
Ms. Kelly. When you add up the federal money, current state funds, and the new appropriation, well, subtract out the new appropriation because that's, we don't know that. But take the federal money, current state appropriation, how many total students are being served in the state right now?
Certainly. Ms. Cohen. The funded enrollment for 2007 is 14,313 children. Am I right, Michelle? I think it's 14,313 children. That's a funded enrollment. Last year we served over 17,000 children because of turnover and constant bringing new children in.
Excellent.
The department is here as well. Representative Eastland?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm not sure I understood your answer to the Chair's question a minute ago when she asked were there any slots open. And I guess, so are there any programs that don't have a waiting list and have an opening?
It's
a question I'm trying I heard kind of an average there, 100% full, but there's programs with waiting lists. Are there programs without waiting lists and open slots?
Ms. Kelly, I'm going to just clarify to you why I asked that question. This has been a little bit of controversy in the past year or two, and that the governor last year proposed a shifting of slots, so to speak. And that was based on, I guess the department can speak to the governor better than me, but I think it was based on that there was, seemed to be, some slots that were maybe not filled. So,
Madam Chair, first of all, I'd like to mention that the department has language in their policy bill that relates to how we're going to count enrollment of future of Head Start. It's in the policy bill that's moved forward through this committee. In the past, we don't have a state system for counting enrollment so that I can give you day-to-day enrollment figures and be able to tell you exactly if there's a program that has an open slot. The way enrollment is counted is that when a child leaves the program, that program has 30 days to fill the slot. And they, if they don't fill that slot in 30 days, that's called under-enrolled, or that's unenrolled. When we look back at figures from last year's data that were reported three months of data, as I said, the average was 100%. There were eight programs that had some slots open at one or more of those 3 months. And the average of that was less. It was in the 90 percentile. It was above 90%. And I think that 73 is a tribal program that doesn't have more than 18 slots, so the average quickly goes down.
Thank you. You know, I think we're all, as we're a committee, and this is our last day of bills, so, you know, not the right time to say this. We're still learning, but we are. You know, we don't know everything, and I think Head Start is one of those things we're all still trying to learn about, and I think we will, over the interim, some of us might want to work with you on to better understanding what's happening with Head Start funding, because it is so complicated, and because it serves the most at-risk kids. So it's that combination we're looking for, but I'm not sure we completely understand. Actually, I'm not sure I do. So with that, Representative Dabney, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Doubling the state's commitment to its poorest and most at-risk kids is an audacious goal. But I'd remind each of the members here that the first time that question formed in your mind, should I run for the state legislature, that too was an audacious goal. Great things can come from setting audacious goals. I ask for your support.
Wow.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We sat next to the floor and we tried to one up each other. That was very good.
I hope you'll take that into your
Yeah, so Representative moves for the chair moves House File 894 for inclusion in the omnibus early childhood learning finance bill. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
With that, members, I need the minutes approved. Is there anybody? Representative Fritz? You move the minutes. Representative Fritz moves approval of the minutes of March 13th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are passed. Next, we have Representative Murphy's bill, House File 796. And also, members, I wanted to let you know that in your packets, the ADE waiting list that we had asked for back at the Hub Center are in there as well. So if you want to look at that. Room change there, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This too is an audacious proposal.
And we're going to have one on each other.
I'm just not nearly so inspiring as Representative Dabney.
Would you like to move the bill?
I would. I would like to move House File 796 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves House File 796 for possible inclusion in the omnibus early childhood learning finance bill. Representative Murphy, if you'd like to discuss your bill.
Thank you, members. I'm here to talk with you a little bit about family, friend, and neighbor child care. Family, friend, and neighbor child care, also known as legally unlicensed child care, is the oldest and most common form of child care in Minnesota. We've spent a great deal of time in this committee discussing how, through public policy, we can take advantage of what we know about early learning, school readiness, and opportunities to address the achievement gap. It is important to acknowledge the important role of families and parents in the healthy development of children. And it's also important to acknowledge that many young children are spending a part of their day in child care settings outside of their home. House File 796 makes available grant funding to organizations working with family, friend, and neighbor child care. 70% of families use Family Friend and Neighbor Child Care in Minnesota. I'm going to call that FFN. It's just a whole lot easier. FFN child care providers are engaged in the care and development of Minnesota's kids, and this bill offers funding to make a popular choice for families even better. Funding this proposal will put Minnesota on the leading edge of FFN child care policy development and will give families choosing FFN child care a more enriched experience for their children. With me today are Terry Vasquez, Kit Hadley, and Richard Chase. They're going to introduce themselves and talk to you a little bit about the proposal. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kit Hadley. I'm the director of the Minneapolis Public Library. We will not achieve the goal of ensuring that all children are ready for kindergarten if we do not pay particular attention to the families who rely on family, friend, and neighbor care. These caregivers are legal and unlicensed. According to the Department of Human Services, more parents regularly use FFN caregivers than use licensed child care providers. And FFN care is especially important to lower-income families and certain cultural communities who trust that the care provided will be right for their children. Public libraries support this initiative because it is also part of our mission to help ensure that all children in our communities are ready for kindergarten. Public libraries have always been part of the community's learning infrastructure that helps parents raise children who love to read. But as in other policy areas, the quantum leap in our understanding of brain development in children has transformed best practices in public libraries. All reading to children is good, but there are ways you can read to children to better ensure that they develop the pre-literacy skills that make them ready for kindergarten. In Minnesota and elsewhere, a study conducted in 2002 by the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development and the Public Library Association demonstrated that parents and caregivers who participated in public library early literacy programs significantly increased their literacy behaviors. Simple interactions with children can enhance literacy development. The results were the most pronounced with teen parents and parents and caregivers with low levels of literacy themselves. The Minneapolis Public Library and the Hennepin County Library were two of 14 participants nationwide in this research. Libraries throughout the state have now adopted early literacy best practices as recommended by this study. And in 2005 and 2006, library staff across the state participated in intensive training in early literacy best practices funded by a federal grant through the State Library Agency. Even in places served only weekly by a bookmobile or where library hours are not what they should be, public libraries are the most widely available public service in the state, regularly reaching a broader cross-section of people than any other public service. Public libraries are at the heart of strengthening the development of a learning culture in families and in communities. In the 2004 DHS statewide household survey, family, friend, and neighbor caregivers reported that the two places they were most likely to go for learning opportunities were the neighborhood school and the local library. This bill, if funded, will provide grants to community partnerships. Public libraries have expanded their involvement in community collaborations to reach parents and caregivers at all income levels, literacy levels, and English language proficiency. Many successful efforts to improve the early learning skill levels and knowledge base of licensed care providers have been undertaken, led by the University of Minnesota and other wonderful organizations in this room. It is harder to reach family, friend, and neighbor caregivers. Public libraries have been involved in community partnerships to improve the skill level of both. These partnerships are evident throughout the state, including initiatives in St. Paul, Dakota County, Isanti, Hennepin County, Brainerd, Minneapolis, and very soon on the White Earth Reservation. But these efforts must be expanded if we want all children to be ready for kindergarten. Public libraries across Minnesota are participants and leaders in community coalitions to improve school readiness, and we are pleased to lend our support to this important bill. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Vasquez, and I'm the Outreach and Business Partnership Coordinator with the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Quality care and education for every child is the tagline for the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network. with 46% of Minnesota families using FFN care as their primary child care arrangement, and an estimate of 150,000 households in Minnesota providing care for family, friends, or neighbors, we have a commitment to this community of child care providers, which is currently not formally served. We've learned that child care resource and referral agencies are uniquely positioned to develop traditional and non-traditional partnerships that enhance quality care, early care, and education on both local and statewide levels. In our 10-year history of working with family, friend, and neighbor caregivers, we have worked to develop systemic best practices, provide greater outreach, and expand, enhance, and develop relationships with organizations and communities to maximize and coordinate resources. Here are some examples of how CCR and our agencies are working to provide training, support, and resources to FFN caregivers in order to improve and promote children's health, safety, nutrition, and school readiness. Partnering with Head Start on the Enhanced Home Visiting Project, and events such as how cooking experiences promote children's development, establishing play and learn groups at local libraries, working with Red Cross on providing CPR and first aid trainings in Spanish and Somali, establishing partnerships with community and state agencies such as relatives of parents, grandparents partnering again, the Center for Africans New to America, and Child Care Assistance to identify caregivers and provide information and resources on topics such as SIDS, chicken baby syndrome, and public health. Offering training opportunities on ADHD, positive discipline, and introducing children to literacy skills at events such as the Fall Harvest of Fun and Learning and the first ever Eager to Learn pilot program, which is online and in Spanish, on Seeds to Emergent Literacy. And also to providing newsletters in English, Spanish, Hmong, and Somali to share developmentally appropriate ideas and activities. We've learned that supporting FFN caregivers is time-intensive, relationship-based work, and funding this important piece of legislation will allow us to expand our outreach and support efforts to these caregivers, working toward truly achieving quality care and education for every child. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
If you could say your name for the record.
I'm Richard Chase, a consulting scientist at Wilder Research. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I've been a lead researcher on several studies of family, friend, and neighbor child care, and I'll save everyone time if I just call it FFN like the other speakers did, including a statewide household survey for the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Kit and Ray already have cited some of the findings from this research, and my remarks are based on that family, friend, and neighbor research. I also want to be clear that I'm not here as an advocate for any particular bill. I'm here as an advocate for database decision-making, good policy decisions for families to improve the lives of families and children in this state. And I think if, as a state, we are interested in promoting healthy child development and school readiness, then supporting FFN family, friend, and neighbor caregivers is a good public policy. One reason for that is that family, friend, and neighbor care is the most common type of child care. You've heard some of that already. And if you want to reach young kids, going through FFN is a good bet. They're primarily relatives. 52% are grandparents. 21% are aunts, cousins, uncles, and siblings over age 12. A smaller proportion are the friends and the neighbors. They're mostly relatives. 70% do use it at some time, and almost half, 46%, is their primary type. And for one in four families, it's the only type of child care that they use. And that percentage is even higher for certain types of families. It increases to over a third when you talk about low-income families, families of color, families in immigrant and refugee communities, and families whose children have special needs. Those types of families often have to rely on family, friend, and neighbor care because it's the only type of care they can afford or find. It's also the most as highest for children age 2 and younger. So you know about brain development. If you want to get your kids early, the better. The earlier, the better you'll get them through their own parents and through their grandparents or the FFN. There's been a lot of misperception about this type of care. It's a positive choice for families. They're looking for someone they know, someone they trust, someone who, and for many of the families we're talking about, it's a pass on their language and in their cultural values. It's also flexible, it's low cost, it's available at times when parents can't find any other type of care, and it's a type of care they can afford. And that's probably testimony for another building today, but I want you to know that too, that it's important to understand that low-income families may not be able to afford other types of care they're looking for. So we learned in the survey that most FFN caregivers, they want support to provide high-quality care. They're looking for that support. 81% are either eager or open to support from a child development specialist and some interaction with other caregivers to improve the quality of their care. 81% are open or eager for that type of support. And what motivates them? They're motivated because they want to aid the healthy development of the children in their care. They're not looking to improve their own skills, become professionals. They want those kids to be healthy and ready for school. More than half of them said in the survey that they would find it very helpful to have information about how to help children learn and do well in school, and also about child safety. Last, any support to these type of caregivers, any way we work with these caregivers, must recognize and be respectful of the strengths they already have, the cultural differences, and that it is essentially a voluntary personal relationship they have in that caregiving. So if we want to improve it, we have to not destroy it in the process. That means that it's got to be targeted, it's better to be neighborhood-based, perhaps library-based, relationship-based, paying attention to culture, the literacy of the caregivers, and the time of day that support's provided. The programs that do this shouldn't expect the family, friend, and neighbors to come to them, but have to build on some natural connections that they already have, where they already congregate, in parks, churches, libraries, in community centers. It's actually the supporting them may take a community organizing approach, building relationships one family or one group of families at a time. So in sum, providing support to family, friend, and neighbor caregivers is good public policy. It's a good way to support children from low-income and cultural communities. But to do it right, it must be flexible, it must be tailored, and it must be voluntary. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I know we have a question from Representative Eastland. I just wanted to say to you all and to the committee that this is a very distinguished group of testifiers, and particularly Mr. Chase has been involved in numerous studies. Can you tell us how many? I remember that one time you had a seminar on all the different child care studies. And so if you ever want to know anything from an objective standpoint, from a research-based standpoint on child care, this is a guy that you want to follow up with. And so how many studies do you think you've done over, last 5 or 10 years, or should we narrow it down?
In the last several years, I've done 4 studies involving family, friend, and neighbor care in the state, including some statewide studies, but also in Rochester, Minnesota as well.
So I think it's important for all of us to know that, and I think some of us, a lot of us struggle with what this care is really all about. As you said, it's really often cost-effective and the most flexible, and somehow, though, there's a feeling that as from the state's viewpoint, you know, we don't want to be too intrusive, but we kind of want to know what's going on and where kids are. So there's this interesting role for the state to play in that, and I think we can't have too much of a role, but we want to be helpful and do training and things where we can.
Right.
Representative Eastland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it Ms. Vasquez?
Yes.
I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network, how that's organized and funded and kind of how it works, just so we can kind of understand it. We've talked about it before, but I'm not sure I really know what it even is and how it works.
We are a network of 19 agencies that serve all 87 counties of the state. And we provide resource and referral information to parents that are looking for care. We support the providers directly through grants and training. And we are established in statute to maintain the data of all the licensed care providers in the state. And so our network office here works to support all of our 19 agencies around the state. So I work directly with those staff in each of our agencies that are working directly with providing outreach to FFM caregivers.
Representative Eastman.
So then you have a board that kind of governs. You have a budget. If you're giving grants, where does the money come from?
Yes.
What's your criteria for giving? What kind of grants do you give? I guess just a little more information about how you function.
Mr. Pasquez.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're funded. The majority of our funding comes from the Department of Human Services. We issue grants through grants advisory committees in each region and district of the state. To varying degrees, you know, up to say $500, $1,000. Providers submit proposals for those grants, whether it's to upgrade their business, say, you know, something that would increase the quality of the care of the children. So it could be an environmental upgrade, something in the home. It could be supplies. It could be funding for TIL 10 training opportunities, because they're required to, licensed providers are required to maintain their license and receive training for that each year.
Person Lisa?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So you have 19 offices,
mm-hmm.
and each office is staffed by a person or a number of people. Like how many people are employed in kind of your organization, and what is your total budget for a year?
Ms. Vasquez, I know that the director is also here. I don't know if you would.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think we just need to make sure
okay
that
to the committee.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. My name is Ann McCulley. I'm Executive Director of the Child Care Resource and Referral Network that we're speaking about. I just want to be clear that the questions are about our network and not that this network is not the recipient of these grant dollars. Okay, then in that case, I'm happy to answer your questions, Representative Eastland. We are primarily, as Ms. Vasquez said, funded through federal, actually, funds that come through the quality dollars, the set-aside dollars from the Department of Human Services. We receive about 80% of our funds that way, 20% through fundraising. We're a separate 501c3, so we have the ability to do that. Our operating budget is about $2.5 million. The system itself receives direct contracts as well from the Department of Human Services, so each of the 19 agencies receive funds that vary in size. Some of our R&Rs are one-person shops. Some are, I don't know what the largest would be, but there's about 100 staff statewide, give or take, right now that serve in some capacity in resource and referral.
Okay. I'll just say this is something I'm also learning more about. I know they did a survey that I took in December, I think, about the network, and they do a lot of the training, so it's the training that the family, friend, and neighbor caregivers get comes a lot through the network, so doing good work. Representative Murphy, as you know, we're on a very tight budget, and there might be just some chance for some one-time money. Do you think you could do this over, or if you had one-time money and just to try the program?
Madam Chair and members, I think this is a really important opportunity for Minnesota. But if you look at the bill, you'll see that we there's a blank appropriation, because I think we understand that budgets are going to be tight. And if the opportunity for one-time funding is the only opportunity, I think that that would be a fine place to start.
Thank you. Any closing comments?
I just want to say this, as we're getting ready to close up our first year worth of committee meetings, I think we have been very sincere in our committee in trying to address an important issue to Minnesota about children and their readiness for school. And we've listened to lots of proposals and lots of people come and talk. And what I have learned through that process is families in Minnesota choose different ways to raise their children. And one of the things I think that challenges us is how to reach those children in a way that, as you said, is not intrusive but effective. And I think this bill is one of the ways to do that. And so I thank you for the opportunity, and I hope to have your support.
Thank you. Representative Murphy moves House File 796 for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee Omnibus Bill. So thank you all.
Thank you.
We have House File 1089, Representative Peterson. Well, they are transitioning. I wanted to introduce two very important people. One, we've had an intern. Oh, sorry, if you want to stand up and maybe introduce it. From the University of Minnesota, involved in the early childhood program there, in graduate student. And so she's been working with our committee, and she's been working on the readathon with Representative Wardlow. So if you, I just want to let you know who she is. Now we're at the end of committee, but she'll also be putting together the readathon along with Nick. Do you want to? Goodwin, who is an intern for the Early Childhood Caucus. So they are good contacts on us. If you see them around, that's what's happening. Representative Wardlow?
I think, Madam Chair, let's be clear about this. They're doing all the work. I just ask them once in a while, what's going on?
Okay, well, they are doing the Early Childhood Readathon, so we appreciate their help very much and hope it's also a learning experience. The other person I have to introduce is my daughter is here today playing her Game Boy, Tori Flowers, who is on...
Family friend and neighbor here.
She's on spring break, so yes. This is flexible and cheap. Excuse me. And effective. She learned a lot today. With that, we will proceed with House File 1089. Representative Peterson, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move bill number 1089. And where's it going? For inclusion in the omnibus bill?
Representative Peterson moves House File 1089 for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And committee members also. I do have several amendments that I'd like you to consider.
Representative Peterson, you want to move your amendments?
All right, I'd like to move the A2 amendment. This is the longer one here.
Representative Peterson moves the A2 amendment.
And it deals with teacher education and compensation helps Minnesota early childhood teacher retention program. Basically, the program to teach. And
we'll move them one at a time.
Okay.
So Representative Peterson moves adoption of the A2 amendments. Is there any discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Amendment is adopted. Do you have another amendment, Representative Peterson?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to, can I step back and just to this one that we just passed, add just a technical. It's a technical error, and instead of Office of Higher Education, it's to the Commissioner of Human Services.
Representative
and
Peterson.
It would be in line 2.29.
Representative Peterson moves to amend the amendment on lines 2.29. What would happen?
Instead of at the end of that line where it says Office of Higher Education, it would be to the Commissioner of Human Services.
House Research, repeat that back.
Madam Chair, the amendment is page 2, line 29, delete Office of, page 2, line 30, delete Higher Education, and insert Commissioner of Human Services.
And then,
is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Your amendment, the amendment is adopted.
And I would like to move Amendment A3.
Representative Peterson moves the A3 amendment. Representative Peterson, would you like to explain your amendment?
Well, it's pretty simple, self-explanatory, I think. It just says there will be a voluntary option. This really addresses Representative Abler's concerns that we'd be mandating this for everybody. And so this addresses his concerns and says it would be voluntary.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The A3 amendment is adopted.
And last but not least, I'd like to move A4, but lines 1.1 through 1.6 only.
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, I have a technical change on this. On line 1.2, it should read page 3 after line 8,
that's
insert.
Okay.
The author could incorporate that if you'd like.
Would you like to incorporate that, Representative Peterson?
Yes, I would.
Could you repeat the changes then?
The amendment that being offered is lines 1.2 through 1.6, with a change on line 1.2. We're deleting 12 and inserting 8.
Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Amendment is adopted. Mm-hmm. Representative Peterson, to your bill.
I have four testifiers, so I'm not going to take a lot of time. However, I do think this is an important bill because just as in K-12 or higher education or the business world, we need continual professional development, whether, and we know that it really makes a difference, particularly in this rapidly changing world of research and knowledge and the need to keep up with the profession. This bill provides that kind of information and opportunity for early caregivers, and I think we need. It also provides a quality rating system. It expands the pilots for the quality rating system, and it requires the Department of Health, in conjunction with community groups, to develop a list of early childhood development training that meet the requirements of 2 hours of such training within a provider's first year of service. We know that these providers need the service, and I think very often are looking for good quality research-based kind of coursework or at least professional development. It provides a more developed and consistent professional development system, and it provides more resources for early childhood providers that would provide opportunities for more productive professional development through grants and scholarships. I think our testifiers will talk more in depth about each of these points, but it certainly is a way to deal with the expanding needs of child care providers in terms of doing their job in a more effective way, and also getting a quality rating system in place so that we know what kinds of situations are available for parents to choose from.
And I just, Representative Peterson, I just want you to know we have about 20 minutes. We have two of your bills. So hopefully, if you're yes. Because you have House File 1325 right. As well. So, testifiers, if you could be brief, we appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Kaner Ross, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill tonight. Just briefly, the bill before you, House File 1089, is a bill that's meant to move child care providers to a point where they really are able to work at their full potential to create a high quality yet affordable setting where providers are loving and well-trained and can operate in a partnership with parents. And when that happens, we know that children thrive, and we know that they arrive on the kindergarten doorstep ready to succeed. And the bill before you really has a number of components that do just that. The bill addresses a number of things that all surround the quality of child care. It includes a structure for the professional development of child care providers, as well as scholarships to help them gain higher levels of education and wage stipends to help them stay in the field. It allows funds to help providers become licensed and accredited, and expands the quality rating system pilots that are currently being rolled out by the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. The Departments of Human Services and Education just released a report based on a series of focus groups done with parents late last year regarding what was important to them in their child care setting. The characteristic of highest importance to parents in the focus groups was the caregiver's training and experience. And so I'd suggest that although the proposals in this bill are highly based on research, that there's qualitative data to show us that this is the direction that parents around the state do want the state to pursue. With that, I'm going to turn the mic over to Karen Cadigan to talk a little bit about quality and professional development.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Karen Cadigan. I'm the Director of Outreach and Public Policy at the University Center for Early Education and Development. Like Richard Chase, I am not an advocate, but an enthusiastic proponent of database decision-making, and hope that I can be helpful in decisions regarding the best use of our limited resources. Two things that research is pretty crystal clear on that can be useful in thinking about this bill, and one sort of suggestion from research. The two clear things are that We know that the quality of environments in which young kids live and learn predicts to a very high degree how happy and healthy they are throughout the rest of their lives. Early development sets a shaky or stable stage on which everything else was built. Second thing is that when you hear the term quality, it's really about the grown-ups. The quality of an early environment is mediated by the grown-ups that are in kids' lives, whether they're parents or non-parental caregivers. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky for public policy making. Can we legislate how grown-ups can do a good job with young kids? Not exactly, and I don't think we would want to. But we can do a better job with the probability game. So, and that's really what a lot of these sort of inputs, professional development, licensing, training, all of that impacts the grown-up's ability to do their job really well. Now, is it possible that someone with no training in child development can do a bang-up job raising young kids? Sure it is. But it's more likely that someone who has a little support and training and professional development and is paid sufficiently is going to do a good job. And we see the direct reflection of that in child outcomes. There's lots of data about nationally accredited centers and how well kids, even kids from very at-risk backgrounds, do in those kind of settings. So in general, it is fair to say that more support, more specialized training leads to better outcomes for young kids. In our contemporary view of early care and education settings, we know that child care is not just babysitting. It's a very important educational setting for kids. And at the moment, unfortunately, many of the supports and requirements and standards for child care are such that child care providers cannot do their best. It's a bit of a missed opportunity. And so between sort of no training at all and having a BA in child development, this bill provides a number of things that sort of inch us a little more toward being more confident that the people caring for young kids that get licenses and that have public funding are going to be doing a good job.
Thank you. Welcome. We have two more, I think. Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kim Stoll. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1089. In my capacity as a grants administrator at Resources for Child Caring, I work closely with the Child Care Services Grants. These grants are available to licensed child care providers, centers, after-school programs, and family, friend, and neighbor providers. The grants are available on a statewide basis, and the funding is allocated to each region. In each region, there's a grants advisory committee that helps identify the identify priorities for meeting their needs in that area. The grants are then awarded based on the provider's needs for things like items and equipment and training to increase the quality of care. The Child Care Services grants that have been funded by Resources for Child Caring focus on meeting the priorities identified in each of the metro counties. These grants include a multicultural component, which focuses on integrating diversity into child care and serving diverse communities. Typical requests include items such as egress windows, fences, cribs, books, educational toys, training, computers, and outdoor equipment. The amount of funding that can be requested with these grants ranges from $500 to $10,000. Additional funding would provide the opportunity for more program children to be impacted by the funding. Throughout the fiscal year, we received inquiries about requests for additional funding and are unable to meet that need. Child care providers who have received a grant have shared their thoughts on the benefits of the grants program. One child care provider stated, "It made me more aware and accountable to the many possibilities of educational activities I can do with the children. The grant has also rejuvenated my spirit and love for teaching by giving me an opportunity to purchase excellent resources and tools that make teaching more fun." Among other things, the process of applying and writing this grant taught me that I can do anything I put my mind to doing. I feel like a more experienced, knowledgeable, and capable person, which in turn helps me to be and feel like a better provider.
Thank you. Welcome to committee. Back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the record, my name is Ann McCulley, Executive Director of Child Care Resource and Referral Network. And my role today is to talk just a little bit about the TEACH program. I will say that the spectrum of things we've been talking about fit within our goal, again, of quality care and education for every child. The TEACH scholarship program is designed to help teachers become better educated while reducing turnover in child care programs. TEACH is a scholarship that helps those working in child care complete a degree in early childhood education. The vast majority of the scholarship money is paid directly to Minnesota colleges for tuition and books, and recipients also receive other supports, including a small travel stipend. Last year, we awarded nearly 200 scholarships to child care providers. On their behalf, we purchased over 2,200 college credits. As a result of their increased education and longevity in the field, these providers saw an average wage increase of 9% and reported a turnover rate of less than 3%. Compared to over 30% in the field as a whole. Once a degree is earned, providers qualify to apply for the Retain Grant Program. This program supports child care workers who hold degrees, allowing them to remain working in child care, a traditionally low-paying field. That means less disruption for children as they prepare for school, and turnover has a dramatic impact on young children. We awarded 160 grants in this category last year. We were unable to get a recipient today. We have had one every other hearing, but I will just read a very brief comment in closing from one of our recipients. I want to thank the TEACH Project for the financial support. It was the last bit of motivation I needed to complete not only my dream, but a promise I made to my father in 1975. I told him I would graduate college with an associate degree or more. He is now 87 years old, so we celebrated in January on his birthday. He had not forgotten the promise. To all of you who work so hard, from all of us who need financial and moral support, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And that's from Nancy Liebelt, who is a family child care provider in Pine County.
Thank you. And I don't know, are there any questions? I have a question. Is the TEACH program in place now? Where does it get its funding from, and what happens if the legislature does or does not fund this program?
Madam Chair and members, the TEACH program now is again primarily funded through federal quality dollars. We have had, since the 5 years the program has been in service, ups and downs of local money. Initially, we had a lot of foundation money, but I think most of you know that foundations, after a while, are not interested in continuing to fund the same thing and have been interested in seeing us receive state dollars to match the federal dollars, hence the request. A few things. We have long wanted to do more outreach of the program. We've had demand now that we've had students go through the associate degree and the bachelor's degree. We've actually had a lot of interest in master's degree, and we have no funding for that currently. And then, frankly, we also could use a lot of, well, I mentioned outreach already, but additional support to make sure if some of the bills that are in discussion here at the legislature move forward, we suspect there will be more of a demand for the TEACH program because people will be interested in achieving higher quality more quickly, perhaps, through that method.
Thank you. Representative Peterson, you're asking for really three different types of programs in here, right? Is that right? So the expanding the quality rating system, the child care service grants, and then the professional development system. How would you rank those if you had to...
just
throw it out. In terms of priority,
my mentor here is saying a little bit in each one of them would be helpful.
That's another way of doing it.
Kind of making them even and giving them each a little bit.
So if there was some one-time funding for a little bit in each area, that might be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Is Representative Eastland?
Madam Chair, I guess just going back to the funding a little bit, you said could you tell us a little bit about the extent of the TEACH program? Same kind of thing that I asked about child care referral. Just maybe how it functions, how many offices you have, where the program head places are, and kind of what your federal funding budget is right now that you're operating with?
Ms.
McCulley?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland. Roughly $800,000 per year is the overall budget. I'd say 90% of that is federal quality set-aside dollars. One office out of the network office with 2.5 FTEs runs the whole thing. Providers apply primarily online or through the mail, so we're able to keep costs very, very low. We take a hard look each year at our geographic balance of providers throughout the state and try to match the giving to the geographic balance. And I don't have the most current figures, but I do have them broken down. I can quickly 16% northeast, 7% northwest, 8% what we call midwest, 4% in the southern, but that was when the program was new, 22% east metro, and 43% west metro. That was at a time when we had some additional dollars. But those come very close to the percentage of the providers in those districts, so truly, truly statewide. That helps.
Yeah, that's good. So when you say your providers, who are your providers?
Ms. McCullough? Madam Chair, Representative Eastland. Child care providers, some Head Start workers. There's a part-time model also for people who work in other early childhood programs that are less than full-time. The vast majority, I would say, actually we're about half and half right now, center staff, and then or program staff and family child care providers.
Okay, so when you're talking about the, you're not talking about them as being providers of your services, you're talking as being child care providers.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, correct.
Okay, then just a couple other questions. I'm looking at the amendment, Amendment A2, I guess on the bottom of the first page of the amendment, maybe it's in here, I'm not seeing it, but there's a match. The recipient gets a scholarship. They have to pay 10% of the cost, and then their employer pays 10% of the cost. Is there any requirement of the scholarship recipient back to their employer if they're getting? Do they have to stay there for a year? Do they have? I don't know. Is there some obligation that they're going to get in return for making the employer pay that?
Ms. McCullen? Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, yes, a commitment to the program requires that on top of having been in the field for a year, the recipient has to agree to stay in the field for an additional year for each contract.
Do they have to stay in the field with that employer?
Ms. McCullough? Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, yes, they have to stay working with the same group of children, actually.
Okay, that's important. And then the other question, maybe this is a technicality, I don't know, maybe I'm not understanding the organization, but the way it's referred to, a nonprofit organization is the way it's established in the beginning, and all the way along it talks about the nonprofit organization, and then on top of page 2.1 it says the organization, and then on line 19 it says the commissioner in consultation with the organizations. And I'm just curious if there's more organizations that are in here than just the one, or if that's enough.
Ms. McCullen, Madam Chair, Representative Eastland will take a crack at it. The organization throughout primarily, I think, is referred to, this is actually a national program that the North Carolina Child Services Administration, I believe it is, licenses. And there is a licensed designated program in each state that takes on the ownership of this program. We are the licensed program in Minnesota, and I believe it mentions that. Why there is a plural, we certainly partner with a number of organizations, and our advisory committee represents a number of organizations. I don't know if that's a typo or not.
Well, it says the organizations named in subdivision 1, which only refers to one organization. So I guess I was just curious if that was kind of a misprint or something that just...
Madam Chair, I defer to your technical staff.
Madam Chair.
Mr. McCormick, Council.
I have two ways to read this, Madam Chair. Either the organization referred to as a nonprofit organization listed in line 1.11, in which case it should be singular, or the organization referred to are the organizations listed in lines 1.19, 1.20, 1.21, in which case the plural is appropriate. And I guess I would refer to the witness desk to answer which of the two they're referring to.
I want to consult. Ms. Kainer-Ross?
Madam Chair, I believe that the section here that Representative Eastland is referring to is actually part of the amendment that was added, a separate amendment that Representative Peterson added to the bill, and I think that this might have inadvertently gotten added into this amendment as well. This section relates to the bill as a whole, but it doesn't actually relate to this particular section. Lines 2.19 actually relates to the professional development system. It doesn't relate to the teacher program.
So with that, I want to ask Mr. McCormick for his counsel on whether we need to fix this.
Madam Chair? My counsel is that you do not need to fix this because I spoke earlier, and it refers to the organizations listed on page 3 of the original bill. Commissioner of Human Services, the Minnesota Licensed Child Family Care Association, and the Minnesota Professional Development Council. Therefore, organizations plural is appropriate.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Representative Winkler, do you have a question?
I do, actually, maybe a couple of questions.
Okay, I'm thinking, you know, what we might do here is table or postpone your other bill until 6 o'clock, until after the dinner break. Representative Peterson, I'm not sure if you have witnesses from that if that will work for them, but...
I have two, but
I think we could probably work something out. Okay. Why don't we do that? We'll finish this bill and then take a break, and so you can ask a couple of questions.
Okay.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McCulley, I'm wondering, just on the program components, subdivision 2, I guess I'm looking at the A2 amendment, but essentially courses leading to an associate's or bachelor's degree in early childhood development and school-aged care, and then you also mentioned a master's degree potentially. And I guess what I'm wondering, it would seem to me that with limited resources, you would want to be broader rather than deeper in the education component. I wonder if you could just speak to plans in that regard.
Ms. McCulley?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I put that out there as one of the examples of the things we're hearing in the field. I think if dollars were on the table, there'd be a look at where the need was the greatest, no question. That's just one of the examples when asked about future that has been raised. As we get more and more students into this and they want to continue to further their education, we have no model and no way to serve them. Whether we do that out of the chute or not, depending on funding, we would make that decision with the advisory committee.
Okay, and Madam Chair, is there a preference for more people getting associate degrees versus, you know, relatively fewer people getting bachelor's degrees with the funds available?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, that tends to be the way things go right now. There's a much higher demand for associate degrees. Part of that also driven by where things are heading and what the requirements are and some of the programs that are out there. But it also obviously is a cost-effective way to move people into the higher ed system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, looking at the quality ranking system, and I know we've had some testimony about this, but I'm just wondering if you could, I don't know if it's you or one of the testifiers, could review briefly what that pilot project has done so far and what the expanded, it says expanding geographically, but it seems to me that the private dollars going into child care is like $1.3 billion annually in Minnesota, which dwarfs any kind of public funds being spent. And therefore, if you could overall improve the quality of the child care system and have this ranking system in place, it would be pretty beneficial broadly. And I'm wondering sort of what the vision for that is and where we are on the path.
Ms. Kainer-Rao?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, what's happened at this point on the quality rating system is that it is there are about three pilots that are being funded through the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. There's a pilot in Minneapolis, a pilot in St. Paul, and a pilot in the Mankato Blue Earth area. They're just starting to get rolling. There are similarities to all three, and there's some difference to each in terms of looking at some different models to see what will work best in terms of both the rating system, but also in terms of increasing the capacity of quality. One of the pilots includes the scholarships that I think you've heard Art Rolnick talk about, which would provide a scholarship to at-risk kids to be in a high-quality program. This proposal here requests some amount of funding in order to create some more geographic diversity to the pilots. Right now, again, there's only the three. It would be nice as we get the outcome data back from the pilots to see a broader range of geographic locations, and so that's what we're looking for here.
Madam Chair, if you can humor me a little bit longer on this. Does that mean that the ratings, there isn't sort of a national model out there or a well-recognized model from other states for rating systems that we sort of have to figure out the best approach?
Ms. McCulley?
Madam Chair, the traveling microphone. Representative Winkler, there are about 15 states, I want to say, who are engaged in some way or another in a quality rating system. What we are trying to do in Minnesota, and the Research and Referral Network is part of
some of the planning around this is draw from the best of what the other states have already learned, what's already in research, and yet take into account the specifics of Minnesota. So just like so many other models, there's not any one thing that I think we would fit exactly, but we're trying to learn the best we can from the other states who have gone before us in this type of rating system.
Representative Winkler, I just want to make a comment. This is a program that was funded last year, recommended by the legislature, the QRS program. As you might recall, the governor vetoed it for $1 million, or was it more than that? And so that was kind of on a path, and then it stepped back, and now it's at MELF with some pilots. I'm going to make an editorial comment because
I sense that coming back.
Yes. Because we're at the end of session and money is tight, and you know my feeling on when money's tight and MELF is piloting programs, but I'm not sure it's the role of the legislature to come along and provide additional funding. Or is it the role of the legislature to see how the pilot projects come out and then maybe make some decisions from there? And I know with the scholarship allowances and so forth, we are looking at funding to rural pilots, but in this one, I think it's going to be much rougher waters. So does that help?
Madam Chair, it does. I guess what I'm trying to understand is if nobody else is doing this in a comprehensive sort of statewide way in other states, how far away might we be from that? How much money, et cetera? I mean, is this really uncharted for us or for everybody? Or, you know, how are we going to get there? How long is it going to take?
Mr. Culling.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I think many of the other states who now are statewide did start in a pilot phase to sort of work out what the uptake would be, what the indicators of quality needed to be, and frankly to ramp up the fund. I wouldn't say that there aren't states that have set again the model statewide. It's just that many did start the way we are starting, which is to test the waters first and then grow from there.
Okay.
And this is, you know, Representative Winkler into the committee, I think this is one of our really fundamental decisions, and other just editorial comments, because I think it's important is as we saw the Senate, the other distinguished body in this legislature, throw out this thing called allowances, and then they needed to be given out by quality rankings, and then we don't have the capacity, from my understanding at this point, to do that in a good way. So I think there is an urgency to getting up to speed and trying to figure out how we do quality in terms of family, friend, and neighbor care, and it's a little more clear on center care, but it's really trying to help families to determine what really makes a quality situation. So as you know, we started out at the beginning of the year with the achievement gap and quality as two of our biggest issues, and now we're kind of ending it and on some of those notes. But I think that's a good thing that we're still struggling with how to do it, and I think asking those questions, if I had it our way, I mean, we'd like to be there. But, yeah, how long is that going to take is an excellent point. I don't think, I'm not sure. If you have some extra money, that's a pot of money. Might
I
be helpful.
Plenty of money into the child care system.
Yeah, I bet you do. So that's, you know, we're moving as fast as the resources let us. And the system is doing something. I mean, I guess that's what I want to say. It's not like there aren't pilots out there.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, any other questions? Representative Peterson, any closing comments?
Okay, my closing comment is just a personal story. I, along with the other grandmother in my family, were left with the care of a 4-year-old granddaughter this past week. And we've been sharing that responsibility, and I have to tell you, it's taken the full energies of both of us to be able to accommodate the schedules of getting her to daycare, picking her up by 4:30, and then seeing that she has all the kinds of needs taken care of. It has been an exhausting week trying to fit it in. So I have had a little taste, once again, of what mothers are contending with. And I still don't know how they all get their children by 4:30. But anyway, be that said, when I go to pick her up on a couple occasions I have, I am so delighted to walk into a licensed daycare center. It's a home, actually, where the woman who runs the center does avail herself of professional development, has people come in to work with the children and communicates with the school system and really has a program. I don't know how she actually does it. She has toddlers to six-year-olds and seems to manage all of them very efficiently and very well. And I know that's not easy. It's probably the hardest job in the world, and yet she does it very well. But I know that she needs training, as all of our daycare providers, whether they're family, friends, and neighbors, or whether they're the licensed daycare people or the licensed daycare centers, they all need these kinds of programs. And I think we're dealing with the most precious resource that we have in this state, and we need to be about seeing that they have quality programs.
Almost going to do the wow that Daphne got. That was a wow, too. So we appreciate you sharing your story.
I knew Daphne.
That
was so busy. Oh. Oh, yeah.
With that, we will recess and reconvene at about this point, about 5 after 6.
Let's call me back to order.
Okay, we'll come back to order. I think it's hard on all of us to take a break and have pizza and get a little bit lighter and then or heavier and come back and do this. But we have the good fortune of finishing up our bills tonight, so it's very important that we're here. We thank people for being here. We are going to go Representative Peterson, Representative Dominguez, second, Yuen Thiessen, and Representative Lane, and Representative Slowitz will be last. So if that doesn't work for some of you, we're moving as fast as we can, but this bill was held over already since 5:30. So Representative Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1325.
So Representative Peterson moves House File 1325 for possible inclusion in an omnibus early childhood learning finance committee.
Thank you. And I also have one short verbal amendment, if that's possible.
Representative Peterson moves an oral amendment. Can you tell us what it is?
It just would be at the beginning. But let's see, it would be line 1.7, I believe. I'm looking just to be sure. 1.7. Let's see. I'm sorry. The lines are different on my old one than my new one. It's right in subdivision 1, programs authorized. And it's just adding a sentence. It says district, and this deals with the question that was asked or the concerns that were raised regarding accountability. And it would say districts receiving funds annually must submit a report to the Commissioner of Education. And that's it. It just simply provides that piece of accountability.
Could you repeat that?
Districts receiving funds annually must submit a report to the Commissioner of Education.
Representative Peterson, I mean, that kind of begs the question of an annual report.
Right.
Okay. So I want to ask Mr. McCormick, as counsel, what do you recommend?
Madam Chair, the way I would word that would be on page 1, line 11, after the period. Districts receiving funds must submit an annual report to the Commissioner of Education.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay. Those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. First of all, this is, for a lot of people who can go back a few years, this is what was referred to as the old High Five program. And there were a number of districts utilizing this concept of funding, consistent, stable funding. And then under Cheryl Pearson Yeke, when she was commissioner, the department, et cetera, recommended cuts. And that was one of the programs that was cut, as I understand the history.
And as a result, districts had to really do away with that method of funding, and as you will hear, many of them have taken it on them, you know, taken it on themselves in a minimal way. And what this would do is kind of reauthorize that old program on a pre-kindergarten program for four-year-olds rather than the fives who didn't make the kindergarten cutoff. So this calls for, I think, a very important concept, and that of providing stable funding for students who are 4 years old and high need, whether it's English as a second language or free and reduced lunch, but those students who are at high risk would be able to get access to this program, and it would provide the district, they would get the per pupil funding at 0.557 of the per pupil aid for the regular students, which would be a half day, just like a half day kindergarten. And it would be a steady, continuous funding stream. And also in my bill, there is the program characteristics follow Dr. Reynolds, and that was referred to earlier today from the University of Minnesota. He has certainly developed some, I think, very fine standards or program characteristics that we ought to have implemented in all of our early childhood programs. And it certainly is talking about not only these characteristics, but it goes into depth about class size ratio, so that's one of the characteristics of 1 to 10, and or 20, but 1 to 10 in a ratio. And they have to have a learning plan, which would be created by the family and the teacher. And I think that overall, Dr. Reynolds' characteristics are very good, but they came out of a seminar held last summer, and you should have the piece in front of you. And the Governor's Summit last year worked very hard at developing what they thought were good characteristics or criteria or standards for early childhood programs. And if you look at them, it's a one page, two side, and it was handed out to you. And those are the kinds of programs that we think every preschool, particularly 4 year old program, should have. But I'm going to let our three testifiers, and I promise they'll be brief so that we can get through this pretty quickly, talk about what they're doing in their particular districts in regard to four-year-olds and the funding pieces that are in place for them.
Welcome to the committee. Who would like to go first? You could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good evening. I'm Sally Ginn. I represent the Robbinsdale School District. I'm the coordinator for early childhood in the district. We are one of the districts that had, we called it Fives Alive. It was High Five in Minneapolis. We called our program Fives Alive. We're fortunate in Robbinsdale to have two distinct programs, one for three to fives. One that was the Fives Alive program was for the five-year-olds, which is what this bill is replacing. We had six classes, served 180-plus kids in 5 days a week, free. They had to show an indication of child or family need on an application process. I will say our programs meet all these standards already. We don't have to even deal with that. but when in Fives Alive has been in Robbinsdale since about 1991, so it was a very steady source of funding until about, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago that it was cut. So now we have two classes in Robbinsdale. The district picked up, allowed us to maintain two classes, but the children have to be 5 years September 1st, but are not ready for kindergarten. So they just became part of the general budget in the school district. So it way limits what we're able to offer. We also have a preschool program that is tuition-based and serves 3 to 5 year olds. We have a sliding fee using state school readiness funding for our 4 year olds. And my visual tonight is to show you this little stack of cards here. This is the wait list of kids from this year that are 4 years old, because that's the only way we're able to help the four-year-olds is with the state funding. These are the kids that will be going to kindergarten next year without having received preschool education. So we really hope that you'll help us out and allow us to serve these kids.
Thank you. Welcome to committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Nancy Kazrowski, and I'm from Bloomington. And I have passed a graph to you. Is that correct? Good. All right. Research has been consistently showing that preparing children for the skills necessary to be consistent in kindergarten and beyond yields the best possible return on investment. Quality, intensive pre-kindergarten programs targeted at children who are at risk for academic achievement can close the achievement gap before children start school so that no child is left behind. Pre-kindergarten programs in Minnesota have been significantly underfunded to meet the growing needs of the young children in our state. The graph that I provided provides a dramatic comparison among funding categories in the Bloomington School District. According to this calculation, we are allotted $61 per child for school readiness to try to provide for children the need with the kind of quality and intensive program that research shows is necessary to teach preschoolers the skills so they can be successful in kindergarten. We have experienced dramatic positive outcomes in Bloomington and Richfield through the Early Reading First program, which is a $3 million three-year grant from No Child Left Behind. Research shows that the program time needs to be significant. Our program meets 5 days a week, 6.5 hours a day, 46 weeks for the children. The program needs to be high quality with research-based curriculum and strategies, continuing staff development and ongoing coaching, licensed teachers, high adult-to-child ratio, parent involvement, and meaningful evaluation. Currently, we have 190 children on our waiting list to get into this program, and they will start kindergarten in the fall with no preschool instruction. And these children on our waiting list for the Early Reading First happen to be English language learners, and they live in households that qualify them for free and reduced lunch. Imagine how not only the lack of language, but other developmental and academic skills will impact the achievement gap beginning that very first day of kindergarten and grow even more significant as time goes on. Many school districts have the infrastructure in place to serve pre-kindergarten children, but do not have the funds to provide the quality and intensity to accomplish the results, nor the money to provide transportation, which is so vital for participation. Most school readiness programs are constantly trying to piece together funding sources with grants or donations or trying to raise funds through the community. These monies are inconsistent and uncertain, which makes it extremely difficult for planning and maintaining a quality staff, not to mention that monies are never enough to serve all the children that are in need. Allocating a weighted per preschooler at risk formula in the district's population, like it is done for kindergarten and grades 1 through 12, would make a difference in supporting schools to ensure all Minnesota children are fully prepared to start kindergarten and beyond, and would give them, the vulnerable children, the stature that they deserve. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Annie Pearson, and thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here with not much of a voice because I need to be a voice for all the children that need us. I'm passionate about early childhood education. I've taught kindergarten and pre-kindergarten in the Minneapolis schools for 28 years. I taught high five for 14 years, and I know firsthand what it can do for kids and for families. High Five in Minneapolis is a high-quality literacy-based program. We were running it using the funds described, and then when those funds were lost, Minneapolis scrambled because it was filling such an important need. We're now offering about half the sessions that we were able to before, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. It's a really successful and high-demand program. The information I passed around shows you some of the data that we've collected. We are serving a higher proportion of free and reduced lunch children than the district average. We are We are serving more children from our highest at-risk groups with the achievement gap. We've got more African-American kids, more Native American kids, more English language learners than the district averages. And while we're doing that, our kids are outscoring the district averages on the beginning of kindergarten assessments. So it shows that, you know, high-quality teachers in a high-quality, developmentally appropriate program can really make a difference. If you're looking at things that are going to close that achievement gap, close the opportunity gap with programs like ours. High Five's popularity is evident. Last year we had 1,100 kids apply for 300 slots. Those slots were funded with title dollars that the district scraped up from other places, with learning readiness dollars and with a little bit of money from a levy. When we are looking at our kids coming into kindergarten in Minneapolis, less than half, you know, look ready according to the standards. And when we screen our kids in Minneapolis, a third of them have criteria that mean they are referred to school readiness programs. So you can see the need is really there. You've all heard all the articles and read all the research, and we were at the Governor's Summit last summer. We know these programs can make a difference. I want to just share with you, I carry these kids around with me in my heart. This is Travell. His mom is doing her part, and she needs us to do our part. His mom sent him the High Five. She moved. She was in a homeless shelter twice over the year. She moved to apartments. Every time she moved, she came in. One time it took 3 buses to get her there, with addresses saying, where do I have to have him be in order to get in here? And if I move to this apartment, can he still come to High Five? This is Munira, who started the year without any English, and by January was creating word problems with her lunch on a daily basis, counting out crackers and telling word problems. And I had to remind her to eat a little more quickly. This is Katya. I had her in my class the year before my last year in High Five. And Katya's dad never showed up for parent workshops or for parent conferences. And finally one day he dropped her off, and I chased him down the hall saying, I just need to tell you wonderful things about your daughter. And he said he didn't speak English, and I said, that's okay, I don't speak Spanish, but we'll find somebody who speaks both. And we did. And we got together, and we talked about all kinds of wonderful things and said that, you know, us working together was what was going to really make a difference for Katya. And he said, well, I work 2 jobs, and my wife works 2 jobs, so we don't have too much time. I said, can you give me 2 minutes? And he said, yep, I can give you 2 minutes a day. So I said, I'm going to send home a book. I'll practice it with her in English. It's just identifying words and looking at the words. I'll have a copy of it in Spanish, and you can read it to her in Spanish. After about 3 days, he sent a note in Spanish, which I had translated, and it said, could we get more books? By winter break, I was sending home like 15 to 20 books a week for the family to read together. The next year, Jonathan showed up. Jonathan is Katya's dad. On the very first day of open house, before school even started, he asked if he could start getting those books because he wanted Jonathan to be just as smart as Katya. Last year at this time, Jonathan's dad chased me down to my new job and said, can you please get Jonathan's little brother in so he can be as smart as Jonathan? And I said, you can turn in your card. We're sure hoping that there's going to be funding for this. Jonathan's little brother is still on the waiting list. Jonathan's dad called again and said, Jonathan's little sister is the right age for High Five. Is there anything I can do? I said, I can come talk to you. And that's what I'm doing today. Jonathan is now in second grade. At the end of first grade, he was reading 120 words a minute. And he's actually participating in some classes for kids that are gifted and talented. I think the thing to think about is just all of the kids who are turning 4 right now and could benefit from this next year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I remember you testified in K-12, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly which. Well, it was on the same bill, right?
Yep.
Yes, that's right. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume you gave them also Nora Swalwick's name so that they can call her. No, I'm just... I think, first of all, when we say pre-kindergarten, which is for 4 years, it doesn't preclude that five-year-olds who miss that deadline couldn't go, and that may happen in these programs. I think, you know, parents look to the school system as a credible structure, and they are hoping that there are classes there for their four-year-olds, a place that they can go to get that kind of education. And I think it's up to us to provide a steady funding stream. You know, we all, I think, agree here about the importance of these programs and know how essential they are for a child's future. But the reality is that there is not a steady stream of funding that you can count on, particularly with four-year-olds, in the system. And this is one place where we could do it. Now, if this bill costs too much money and the initial runs do look like it's a bit costly, it's statewide and it takes in all of the at-risk and LEP learners. However, this could be certainly fixed to be a much narrower group of students, and that could be using either just those that get free lunch, not free and reduced, just free lunch, and then you narrow it further. Or you could use the Learning First model, which has a method that, or a model, I should say, of finding in each district or in quadrants around the area of the schools or the students who are the most needy and who you could put some weighting that they could get those programs first. And we could trim it to the point. I mean, you start with the money first that you can afford, and then you start developing that system of paring down the number of students. But obviously, any kind of program that we're doing would provide more opportunities than we're getting now, because it's pretty just bare bones. And we're leaving out a lot of kids who really aren't getting those services. This really is a funding, stable funding source to provide the kind of services. And quite frankly, I have to tell you, it is cheaper than allowances or scholarships or vouchers or any other kind of name you want to put to the kinds of things that are being proposed. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to seriously look at this as an option. And with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
This is my fifth bill, so that's why I'm a little crazy today.
It's been a long day. A lot of our members are in other committees.
I see that, and I have to go off to one, too.
Yeah. You know, I am just going to say this publicly because we need to have this conversation about what we're doing with our four-year-olds, what we're doing with, and what we're doing with school readiness, and what we're going to do, we'll do with high fives. As you know, this isn't going to be the year for this, you guys. I mean, I hate to tell you that, but there just isn't enough money here at the legislature. But what I want to talk to you about is coming back to us, and what we're doing with our school readiness money, and doing potentially a conversion into high five. And I'm going to throw that out. I don't know how many people are going to say, do what? But that would be a pot of money we could convert, sort of. But, well, that means there's school readiness funds that are out there through a formula. So they're being funded, but, you know, potentially take that pool and use it, shift it to the 557 weighting, and then direct it towards four-year-olds at risk. But then that makes the school readiness money go away, and that means somebody is not going to be happy.
Madam Chair, I see no reason why there should be conflict with that concept. And I've been thinking about that because the issue was raised to me by some of the readiness folks. It seems to me the people who are currently working in the readiness would stay working it, and probably stay working in the readiness. They just would have a steady fund or flow of money that's substantial and that would make a difference. I mean, when you're dealing with, what, 60-some dollars per pupil, that is not the kind of dollars that you can build an effective program around. And so I think there's a lot of room, but you're right about one thing. We've not had time to really talk with those folks about how this could work. And I think once that's been vetted, we could probably get a lot of agreement around this.
Yeah,
I think everybody wants solid, stable funding.
I see the same poll of Minneapolis people are already in conversation. And that is something I think we should seriously look at. And that means that we wouldn't have to come up with new money. That's what
right.
that means. But what the issue is going to be is what kids are being served currently versus what kids could be served if we shift it to a high five sort of format, and then what are the benefits and to what kids and then what districts. And then you get into the politics of where the money goes. But so I'm very interested, and I think we're very interested in your concept. It's just that we need to find a funding source, as you say, and this year I think
most of you know that all day kindergarten is just a little bit up there. They're changing the weightings from 5.57 to somewhere between 0.8 and 1.2. So they're changing a significant weighting this year. There's the potential to change a significant weighting this year to fund all day kindergarten. And so we can only do things incrementally here at the legislature. But the good part about that is if we do that this year, then the next group that is open is four-year-olds. And you take care of the five-year-olds in all-day kindergarten, then we could maybe come down and do this. I mean, we'll see. And I'm not sure all of that's going to be, there's not enough money even to do all of that right now.
And, Madam Chair, I'm hearing what you say, but, you know, as we get into conference committee, if indeed the Senate has $400 million over the biennium, we might be able to scrape some out of that. So that's the one thing to keep in mind, because then it all becomes wide open. So
yes.
I'm going to leave that thought with
right.
you as you get into the conference committee.
Well, we will, any questions or Representative Blythe?
I just want to thank you, Representative Peterson, for being such a strong advocate for these programs and for you, your strong voices. You spoke so well eloquently for them, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Blythe.
And this does, I mean, this puts you in the mix, and that's what Representative Peterson is saying, is the mix is the beginning is when we get targets, and those are announced, and then we announce it sort of our committees and pass our bill out next week, and then the end is conference committee, and there's a long road between now and then. So maybe you can help us acquaint with the legislators, which are the best thing to do is yet. In other words, we're not sure, and we're trying to figure out what to do with the money we have and the best way to do it. So there's a really honest conversation in public, right? Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 1325 be included in the omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee bill. Possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Dominguez.
She's leaving too.
I'm glad we're in this room. Well, I
have to
say, because it would be
just you and me.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Dominguez. We're down to just a few committee members because every committee is meeting, but we very much appreciate you being here. And do you want to? I can move your bill. The House moves House File 580 for possible inclusion in the omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. Representative Dominguez, do you have a delete all?
I have an amendment, Madam Chair, DE1.
DE1. Representative Dominguez moves, or the chair moves, the DE1 amendment. Representative Dominguez, do you want to talk about your amendment, or is it just getting your bill in the shape
just
you want?
Just getting the bill in the shape that we want it to work with.
The bill in the shape we want it. Although, any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Dominguez, if you could tell us about your bill and
okay.
how you aspires.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I know how it is. I'm running back and forth, too, to different bill hearings. I got another one coming up. And thank you for putting this on the agenda in the beginning, because I have another bill that needs to be heard also. And I have another committee, two other committees that are going on, too. So we will quickly go through this bill, hopefully, if there's any questions. And I also brought some testifiers along with me, so I'm not going to take too much time in explaining this, but I will explain a little bit about what's going on. And thank you for that doing that amendment, Madam Chair. I know that you and I are working on this bill, and I think it's a beautiful thing that we can come together and work some things out for our kids. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm going to explain a little bit about this bill. This bill relates to education, reinstating the after-school enrichment program, providing grants for economic achievement, reducing crime, and improving community involvement. It also is increasing the character of development of our kids. So, Madam Chair, we as community folks and as a person that did receive funds from these grants in the past, I know these programs can work. As a past executive director and a past president of the Northside Community Collaboratives, These programs did work in our community on the north side. And to be frank, Madam Chair, these programs were statewide. I want to bring that point to you because it's just not a certain area of group that received these funds. It was statewide. And I handed out some handouts, and it tells the difference between, it tells you where the grants were initiated, the grants that were received. So again, Madam Chair and members, it was statewide programming. I just want to make sure that we understand that. One other point that I want to make, Madam Chair, is that as we go along, I've had the opportunity of working with folks that worked with you on your proposal, and we came to some good conclusions. The new amendment reads, and I won't go through it. If members want to read it, that's fine. If they have questions, then we'll go from there. But again, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to the testifiers today, and we also have a couple young men that would like to say a few words. So my first testifier will be V.J. Smith. He heads two programs, Legacy Village, and also you may have seen him in the streets working with Mad Dads in the vigils and working through the communities to help stream the crime that's going, especially on the Minneapolis area. So, but he's statewide. He goes statewide, and so I'm going to turn that over to him, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record. And
my name is. Everybody's got this voice thing going on now. V.J. Smith with Mad Dads. Welcome. Good afternoon to you, Madam Chair, and everybody on the committee. How y'all doing? Doing okay?
Yeah.
All right, let me get a little energy flowing. You know, back in when Mad Dad started in 98, I was working the after-school program that was funded by these funds, and what it did is it helped me get Mad Dad started, which now is on its own. It's its own 501(c). But we were able to take those dollars and take kids that were struggling after school, had, number one, nowhere really to go, no one was home, which causes girls to get pregnant, which causes crime in the community, which causes a lot of situations. We were able to take 50, 60 kids and change their lives with just a little bit of money. And I know it can make a big difference, but I thought what's really, really crucial is from that little bit of money started an organization called Mad Dads, Men Against Destruction, Defending Against Drugs and Social Disorder. Now we're on the buses, making it safe on the buses. We've got about 50,000 hours on the streets, and that's all I do now. So from that little after-school program, from those seed monies, came another program, which is now doing great things. But I want you to hear from the kids. Maybe we're wondering, do they get a pack of cookies, too?
Yeah. Do you want some cookies?
Well, I want you to hear from this young man because he's here because this is a program for him after school. These two young men are in high school, and I want you to hear from him why it's so important to have something to do after school.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Brandon Kirk, and work with VJ. And
why is it so important
after school? Because to stay positive, stay off the streets, do something constructive, be against destructive. So.
How old are you?
I'm 16.
Where do you go to school?
Roosevelt High School.
And what do you do after school when you go to the program?
Usually be with VJ. We usually do outreach patrol or do anything that's up to him.
Good. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record.
Good evening. I'm Montrell Donaldson. I'm 17. I also go to Roosevelt High School. And after school programs is a good way to keep the violence off the street because it keeps teens and younger kids out of, you know, the way of drugs and out of the way of gang members who try to pull them in. It keeps them positive and gives them things to do after school to keep their lives constructive and to keep them positive.
There are a lot of gangs at your school?
Yes, quite a lot different. You know, it comes with the cultures that's at our school too, so it's a lot of gangs, and we try to stay positive there as much as we can.
Okay. Well, good for you. Well, thank you for coming today and talking about what you do after school. It's important for helping get Representative Dominguez get his funding here today. Good. Thank you.
I just want to make one quick statement real quick. He was on the news, and he went back to school. We had a vigil, and he said, made a statement. It's hard. Some days I go to school, and I'm not sure if I'm going to come home because of the gang violence in my school and in the community. And his students, some of the students kind of looked down on him, and he said there were other students that looked up to him and said, I believe the same thing, too. And so he's able to be an image for the community by doing something positive, being with me no matter what I do. I'm always doing something positive, so they get an opportunity to do that. And they're also, we're grooming them to be the future leaders, so when I die, somebody else can take control of Mad Dads. Right, fellas?
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. You can state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Richard Mammon. I'm Director of Community Recreation Services for the City of Minneapolis, and I hate following VJ at anything. So. How y'all doing?
The last time you were introduced as a legend, as I recall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for reminding me, which is a kind way of stating elderly and long in the tooth in youth work. I've been a youth worker for 30 years, and I'm really here to reinforce what these young men have to say about the importance of this bill. And the other thing I really want to point out is that we know this kind of activity works in Minneapolis and St. Paul and in Marshall and Northfield and Red Lake and other places throughout the state. We know that the young people need additional supports that are just not available in homes, in the schools, and we've got to do some things differently. So one of the things that we did learn from our past is that after-school programs have demonstrable effects, and they do have impacts, and they're impacts that are more important now than they were 10 years ago when the original bill was passed. You know, we know that 59,000 participants in the program being involved at least 3 hours when it was last counted, I believe, in 2003, showed a 31% increase in participation. There was a 38% decrease in juvenile crime for the kids that were involved. There were 74% reported that they were more involved in community service. We know that 76% reported increased academic achievement. 47% reported improved school attendance. 82% reported increased skill in technology. These are things that we can't afford to not do. I mean, we cannot afford failure anymore. We know that these guys, not only are they replacing VJ, they're paying, you know, Social Security for us. The effects that the cuts that we've seen, at least in local services in my community in Minneapolis over the last 5 years, have been dramatic. And we've struggled to find new ways. Now, we've got new partners. We've found ways to collaborate together. Schools and parks are working together with YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs in ways that we haven't before. The bill that Representative Dominguez has presented and the bill that you've presented, Madam Chair, House File 976, leverages other support from private funders. And we think that, you know, this kind of partnership is what we've got to demonstrate to our children, to our communities, and that we can do this. So I really, really want to encourage you to support this bill in whatever form it takes. It's critical, and we need new legends. There's no doubt about it, to carry things forward. And I also want to point out, I know Dr. Richard Chase from the Wilder Foundation is here. Before, I was talking, he gave me an interesting statistic saying that I believe that it was, you know, 10 to 12-year-olds are essentially raising themselves more in the last 5 years. Has gone from 20% to 40% of kids being home alone.
Right. As a parent of kids that age, I mean, that's who are on spring break this week, it's very true because a lot of parents are working and it's hard to find that those good quality programs, especially for kids as they get up past about 12, especially, it's a lot harder. And Mr. Mammon, tell us what about when the programs were unallotted and what happened.
Well, Madam Chair, in 2003, what we saw is a tremendous reduction in the number of community supports. the Minneapolis Park Board did not receive any funding in the earlier years, but what did happen is the programs that had received funding, they're being vacant, increased the number of kids that we saw in our parks hanging out after school because they didn't want to be home. They didn't feel safe. Sometimes they were there because it was a safe place. They couldn't be just in the community. There are gangs. We've seen a tremendous number of offenses and juvenile crime, at least in our community. Is it a direct effect of this? Who can say? But we do know that there's less support. There's less thing. The Boys and Girls Club has to close at 6 o'clock on Friday because they can't afford to stay open. That creates, you know, an impact elsewhere. So it, I know for us, in the park board, we've lost about 25% of our recreation center staff. Minneapolis is very proud to have 49 centers, but we now have skeletal staffs because we cannot afford to operate them as much. With that, we don't have as much support for the kids that show up there, or the programs for their parents, or the programs to get their parents to be more involved volunteering, creating grading programs for kids. That's how this community building thing works. But when you take away significant pieces, you can't do those other things.
Well, and just for the community members that are here, that in 2003, the governor unallotted these grants. So there was a grant program in place, and we were funding it. And then when an unallotment is an automatic stopping of the funds. And so the programs, many of them just, I don't know how many closed, but a lot of them had significant reductions. And then the state never has reinstated the funds. So what we're trying to do with these bills is get some good after-school statewide grants going. Representative Dominguez, I think that there's still some compromising to do between me and you and our bills, and I just wanted to let you know that. And we're going to consider your bill very carefully, but for the members, there are two different versions, two different sort of ideas out there on how to fund this. Also, Representative Dominguez, there's not very much money here at the legislature, we're finding out. And how do you feel about the program being funded on one-time funding?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess that's the conversation we need to take. I just failed to mention also to members and Chair that I know that we did receive some initial contact with the foundation of supporting this program by $1.5 million. That's the McKnight Foundation. So with that support, I hope that we can continue with this type of programming. Again, as the question was, I think that we need to sit down and discuss those issues, and hopefully we can come up with the dollars that these programs can continue. I don't think band-aiding a program is good. I think we need to continue these programs as the legend talked about. I think we really seriously have to look at what's really helping our children and our communities. This is just not one community. This is the whole state. And I do believe that has helped the whole state with their youth, bringing them up. We talk about No Child Left Behind. I think we need to really seriously think about those kids that are left behind, that are not getting tutoring, that are not getting after-school programming that could help with their grades. Those are the things that we've been talking about. And if it's education that the state, the House, and the Senate is talking about, I think we really need to think about those initiatives. So, again, it would hurt this program if we only got one-time funding, but those are the discussions. Laura's here also, who has been working with us in this proposal.
Thank you, Representative Dominguez.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura LaCroix-DeLune with Youth Community Connections. And just to clarify for the record, the DE1 amendment that was adopted brings the language in line with the other bill that Representative Slawick was mentioning prior to leaving the room. So they are aligned at this point in time with the adoption of that language, with the exception of one additional outcome on the crime prevention outcome.
We'll make sure she is aware of that. I just wanted to say one thing. I've spent a good part of my teaching career working with
young people who struggle. We used to call them at-risk students. I recently read a book by Lee Stringer. I don't know if you are familiar with Lee Stringer or not. He wrote a book about his experience being homeless, and the title of his book was Grand Central Winter, in which he described his life living underneath Grand Central Station. I heard an interview with him, and he said he was asked what was it like to be a at-risk kid growing up. And his answer was, well, all kids are at risk. The problem is not all kids have someone there to catch them when they fall. I want to thank you for being there to catch these kids when they fell.
Thank you. Thank you very much, sir. Thanks for the cookies, too.
Yeah. Okay, so your bill has been moved, and we'll lay it over for consideration on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate it. Thank you, members, and we look forward to working with the others on this bill. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Thiessen. Representative Thiessen, I'll move your bill, House File number 916, for to be laid over for consideration for the Early Childhood Committee.
Thank you very much. This bill is, fairly straightforward. It would move us back to kind of our historical model of having annual inspections of licensed daycares and family daycare centers, and would also call for an analysis of how we would implement an initial visitation with legal non-licensed daycare. And that kind of is the issue. I'll turn it over to Ms. Kainer-Roth here.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Kainer-Roth, and I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. And as Representative Thiessen said, the bill is quite straightforward. It brings us back into line with the majority of states, which do require at least an annual licensing visit for both child care centers and family daycare homes. You would actually have a handout in front of you that shows, or perhaps in your packet, that shows sort of the spread of frequency among states. And Minnesota is, I believe, in the bottom 10 of states in terms of frequency for licensing visits. This really is considered best practice, and it was something that Minnesota did up until 1993. And even after it was not required any longer, most counties and the state did try to continue to do annual licensing fees until resources really prevented them from doing so. So the first part of the bill really brings us back into line with the majority of states. The second piece addresses unlicensed providers that receive child care assistance funds for the children they care for. Currently, the only relationship the state has with them, aside from paying them, is to do a background study prior to them starting to receive the funding. This suggests that it would be wise for the state to create a plan for doing a one-time visit with those providers to bring different types of resources, which could be early childhood development information, school readiness information, could be health and safety information, could be a fire detector. But what we hope to see here is some level of relationship between the state and unlicensed providers, and we think that both of these provisions really would increase the health and safety of child care settings in the state. And with that, I'll just stop there, and Richard Chase is here to speak quickly to the second part of the bill.
Thanks, Anne.
Okay. Introduce yourself for that.
Richard Chase, consulting scientist from Wilder Research.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee member. All right, I'm going to build off of what I said earlier about the family, friend, and neighbor care. Everything I said before is actually more so for those that are receiving child care assistance for family, friend, and neighbors. It's about 5% of the family, friend, and neighbor caregivers are receiving serving kids through the child care assistance program. And it's about 16,500 kids that are affected by this right now. They're very similar to family, friend, and neighbors in general. So, half relatives, half grandparents, you know, the same makeup as the other caregivers. But what's a lot different is that on average they're doing this 38 hours a week. So it's really a full-time position for them compared to 19% for caregivers overall. And they're doing it in their own homes primarily. When we talk to them, just like the other caregivers, even more so, they're looking for this type of support that, that Ann was talking about. 72% said that it would be very helpful to get access to small grants to pay for books, educational toys and games, other materials to teach kids how the skills they need for school. And 38% of Family Friendly Neighbors said that overall. So they're really into the helping kids get ready for school. 55% said it would be very helpful to have access to safety equipment or supplies. And two-thirds are looking for access to various government programs, a food program, and to have more information about how to help kids succeed in school and how to help them with any special speech or language or learning problems. Just what I said for other caregivers, too, any plan to help these caregivers also has to be respectful of their strengths. It should not be deficit-based. It should assume that these parents, these grandparents, these caregivers are doing a good job but are looking for more support than they have now, and should be done in such a way that it's respectful and it builds on those strengths and does not. You'll get more people wanting a visit and actually asking for more visits if you go there with opening up access to resources than you do with looking for trouble. Thank you.
Anything else you'd like to say?
No. I think it's really a very good direction. We need to move back in the direction of annual inspections, which is where we have been. And I think if we're investing our public dollars in providing and helping with this daycare, we ought to also try to support those folks so that we get the best outcomes we can.
Any questions, Linda? Seeing none, that will
thank you very much.
Move the bill as stated before to be included in on this bill with the Early Childhood Committee. Glad you made it back to present your bill, Representative Lane. Would you like to move it?
Yes, I would like to move House File 1187.
To be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Do you have any amendments?
No.
Go ahead and present your bill.
Mr. Chair, we'll have to share this information with everyone else to make sure that they're up to par on this because it's very interesting.
I'm glad I'm here to hear it.
Actually, through my own work and interest in neurotechnology, I became aware of New Vision's charter school in Minneapolis, and I went there to check them out and what they were doing, and I saw some of the methods they were using. And it uses, for instance, get the child through audiovisual binaural stimulation to brain states where they can focus more or calm down, and then they can return to the classroom ready to learn. And they are working with other schools in these techniques, but it's always a matter of funding. And now they're trying to bring some of these ways of stimulating healthy brain development to early education, to preschool teachers. And it's very innovative. It's very research-based for brain research. And I think it's just wonderful. I think it's just something that needs to go forth. And it's only what I call a small amount, $75,000 a year. But this is really to be leveraged to a much larger effect because it teaches the teachers. And it trains the teachers in these methods, and they can use stimulation of healthy brain development to help youngsters in learning readiness. And we have two testifiers here to tell you about what the program involves and how they would use this funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bob DeBort. And the co-founder of New Vision's Charter School. And we were one of the charters that took to heart the potential charters have for education, and that we developed three interventions that seemed to accelerate children's reading skills. And this, we are one of the first charter schools in the state. And we had three programs, one called SMART, Boost Up, which in your packet you'll see pictures of the activities. It's basically stimulating the brain in the part of the area that controls the readiness skills that teachers take for granted are in place when a kid walks into the school. And by doing enough repetition and stimulation, we're able to make automatic skills become automatic that are necessary for good reading skills. And so we had the SMART program, we had EEG neurotechnology, we're able to have children drive video games with their mind, and by doing that they're able to get off Ritalin if they had ADD and ADHD. And then we had an auditory program. And so we had a lot of data and evidence showing that we were accelerating children's performance in reading. And we also had evidence from the beginning that we were closing the achievement gap that a lot of policymakers have been concerned about, because the children of color were making equal or more gains than the European American children in reading skills. So teachers began coming to us asking how they could learn how to do these techniques. We went to the legislature in 1999 proposing that we could replicate those three interventions and work with traditional schools throughout the state. So in your packet there is a map showing you the schools that we've worked with throughout the state of Minnesota in K through 6 classrooms. And basically what happens is that schools send a team of teachers to our 4-day workshops where we train them in how the brain develops, how you can speed up brain development, and how that's related to learning and reading. Then our mentors go out into the schools on a monthly basis to mentor them in the implementation of the program, because people go to workshops, they get real excited, and then Monday morning comes along and the inertia of your life and everything else, it's hard to apply. So the mentoring has been key, we found, over the years that we've been doing this. We've been doing this since 1999, and there is a packet with some of the reading scores. We've always been collecting data. So with kindergartners, 72% of them are above the national mean. With first graders, they're reading faster than their peers. And second graders, same thing. So we've known that you could take these interventions and implement them systemically in entire classrooms, and through mentoring, produce gains that stay with kids. And we also knew that children, when they're young, 95% of their neurological development happens in the first 6 years of life. So if we work with them younger, we could get better gains. And so we're in a pilot project this year, working with 22 Head Starts throughout the state of Minnesota, up in the Mojave area, which is Becker, Manoman, and Hubbard County, and then with Anoka, Washington Head Starts. Jackie Cross is the executive director. Apologize for not being able to be here tonight, but she's at a early childhood conference in Bemidji. So we're working with those sites with over 200 Head Start children, and we're adapting everything to working with 4- and 5-year-olds. We're changing all the work we've been doing for the last 6 years to make it developmentally appropriate for the kids and for the teachers. And what we intend to do over the 3 years, and we're in the first year, is to not only have a longitudinal component to what we're learning. In other words, we're going to follow them into kindergarten, first grade, to be able to document and bring back to you that, yes, this method does produce readiness skills and success in school, but also to compare those kids who are getting the SMART program and not. And so we've started this year, and the request is a one-time request, because it's very modest, because I don't believe in coming to you and asking you to use taxpayers' dollars unless we can have hard data. And so it's a modest request. But I want to turn over the testimony to one of the Head Start centers who just started working with my office.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. I'm Monica Marks. I'm a head teacher for Anoka, Washington County Head Start. I wrote something small here, but I could go on and on and on about how much it's helped the kids in my classroom. I work with 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds. I have 18 children in my classroom. As we listened to the SMART trainers this past fall, the behaviors we had seen in the past years finally made sense to us. And now we could refocus our teaching accordingly and according to SMART. The past 5 months of on-site mentoring has made a tremendous difference in how myself and my teaching team have been able to implement the program. Mentors started out visiting us every other week, and now we see them once a month. During that time, they observe our program and the children and give us tips to how to keep the program moving forward. They also meet with us at the end of our time with the children to answer questions and review how the program is going. Without the mentors coming to help, the program would not be as successful as it is. The parents and children in our class are so positive and excited about the program and the outcomes they have been seeing at home and school.
For lower-income families to have the same opportunity to have their children to be as successful as middle and upper-class children has lifelong impacts. Parents come in and tell us they have seen behavior changes, eyesight changes, and learning changes in their children. And this in itself is amazing and proof that SMART works. We look forward to having our SMART Head Start children ready to enter kindergarten. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to miss part of your testimony. I had to pull up on another committee. I just kind of want to ask a question. Sure. I'm asking most of the testifiers is to Representative Lane, but then to you as well is, and I think this is actually designed as one-time funding, right?
Right.
So one-time funding would be acceptable, and then $75,000 a year is what you're asking for. And what exactly will that pay for?
What that allows us to do is to have a full-time mentor for the Head Start centers, as well as it allow us to gather the data. That's the thing that we feel we will, in 2 years, have something to contribute to the public discussion about what should we do with early childhood. Part of it is replacing the cuts that have happened, but part of it also is, you know, what interventions are effective and what's cost effective to do. And our experience in the K-6 setting is that there's a handout where our cost to provide our program is like $109 per student of the kids that we work with in K-6. So we feel that we'll have a longitudinal and a controlled experimental kind of design for data to contribute to the public dialogue of where should we go with limited resources.
You know, I think I'd like to add an amendment to the bill to require you to give us a report back after, would it be 2 years, to talk about your, what I'm trying to think of the best way to word this. So you're going to be doing a study, and you're going to have a mentor for 2 years, and trying to think what would be included in that, but it require you have a study back based on reporting back on how your study went and progress in the program. And can council suggest?
Can you help us with that?
Yeah, we require a lot of reports usually here, but this is a common.
I'm sure what I would do is insert a subdivision 3 after line 1.14, which would have a head note report that would state that the Minnesota Learning Resource Center shall report to the House and Senate committees responsible for early education programs regarding the success of the program. And I could suggest any other language.
Would you say like a written report? Or
I would suggest testimony, but if you're going to do a written report, how we can put a written report in.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. As well.
Mr. McCormick, well, how do we, here's the problem, and I already think 2 years out, how are we going to remember, if it's not a written report, how in the world do I remember to ask them to testify? 2 years, that would be after the election.
Absolutely.
Absolutely,
Madam Chair. We'll have a written report.
Yeah, that might be best.
And Representative Lane, would you like to incorporate that into your bill? Okay.
I guess I would like, and then I'd like some kind of a deadline and written report by, what would you suggest?
Usually, Madam Chair, I put January 15th of the reporting year, and since this is going to be 2 years out, I think it'd be January 15th, 2009.
Okay.
By the way, January 15th is something that we were paying in the Senate because nobody's here on January 15th.
Yeah, that's true. That's much smarter.
Thank you, Mr. Cormick. President Slavik, do you have any other comments?
I just wonder if Mr. McCormick wants to read it so that the author knows kind of what it says. And
It will read, Madam Chair, Subdivision 3 report. By January 15, 2009, the Minnesota Learning Resource Center shall report in writing to the committees of the House and the Senate responsible for early childhood programs regarding the findings of this program and the success it has had. And I might clean that up a little bit, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Hey, do you have any further...
just have one more.
Any other comments on the amendment?
One more question. Oh, okay, wait.
Well,
after
you know,
the amendment.
If she is really willing to incorporate it, do we need to vote on it?
You don't.
Okay. So she said she was willing to incorporate it. So, you have another question?
Yes. I have a question for you because we're working on... ramping up the intensity of Head Start. I know we've met, and I know Jackie Cross, and she's wonderful and everything. But we're also hearing, we've heard testimony in the last 2 weeks on both Words Work program. If you're familiar with that, that's an intensity literacy program. And we've also heard about the one that's happening up in the SCRED district, the Serve Minnesota, where they use the Reading Corps program. So yours isn't reading, it's more mentoring. I guess I'm just trying to distinguish in my mind the difference between those opportunities.
Representative Slavik and Chair, I appreciate the question. It's a really key, important distinction. What we're doing is, when Commissioner Sebring says there's half the kids going to kindergarten aren't ready for learning, and when National Reading Commission says 37% of American fourth graders can't read at a basic level, and then when the University of Minnesota says that a third of the kids going into college in Minnesota state system coming from Minnesota high schools need remedial reading and writing and math and tutoring, those are all the same children. And how we look at it is that for whatever reasons, and there's many reasons we can share, for whatever reasons, those children have what we refer to as readiness field deficits, so the information isn't coming in clearly and consistently. And so the SMART activities and the SMART Booster program, with all of the movement, the crawling, the creeping, the monkey ladders, all those things, stimulates that part of the brain so these children will go into school with a sound foundation for learning. So whatever the school then will use for instruction, they'll be able to benefit from it.
I see.
And a lot of those other two interventions are aimed more at the cortex. Think about this. And so if the information isn't going to come in clearly and consistently, no amount of RTI or these other things will get past that. So we're laying the developmental foundation so they could benefit from RTI or the SERV program, which is basically a tutoring intervention as well.
I see.
I don't know if that's...
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I had a little guy with problems, so I get some of this, and there's, the way I think we talked about this, there's the interventions are not unlimited, but many. There's lots to choose from, and you're kind of choosing your way to do it, and yours has proven to be effective. So I guess that's our choice here at the legislature to decide what we want to invest in. I think we are trying to find out what can increase close achievement gaps. So I think it would be interesting to see if we do this here and that, say, Words Work and serve in another committee. It might be interesting to do a side-by-side comparison and see kind of what happens there. So, it's just interesting to see the variety.
Could you state your name again?
Yes, Monica Marks, again from Head Start, from Washington County Head Start. The main thing that when I was going through the training that made me go, aha, was that infants are not getting the baby time on the floor on their bellies, and a lot of parents are busy working. A lot of parents don't care. Maybe lower income families, they don't have the time to sit, or maybe don't want to sit because there's so much going on in their lives, money and everything. So that part to me was made a big difference on how I saw this program, because when you think about not getting that crawl time and not learning that one arm and one leg and jumping up and down and maybe a jumper or a walker or whatever, they were just here back and forth on the floor and getting all that brain stimulation. Then I looked back in the past 7 years that I've been teaching and looking at the behaviors I've seen, then I see that's probably why this child was acting that way, or not fully maybe, but then if I would have had this information then, maybe I could have helped that child a little bit more than what I did. And so far in my class, I've seen kids coming in screaming, crying, can't sit still, to sitting through 20 minutes of story time now instead of up and down and climbing cots and everything else. So that was the main difference, I think, between the literacy and tutoring and stuff. That
thank you. Reminds me a little bit. I read a book several years ago called Brain Gym, which talked about the same kind of connection. And it occurs to me, too, that so much emphasis on the academic really does miss the point if there isn't, as you say, that brain development there. And many of the activities that
have early childhood teachers use with kids is really aimed at doing those, laying that foundation. And we need to not forget that, that those are important brain development things happening, and allowing the brain to develop in that way is really important.
Mr. Chairman, when we started working back in the late 80s, 20 years ago, in Minneapolis, public schools had 10 to 12% of their kids flunking kindergarten. And what they would do is have them repeat kindergarten in an all-day format. And so 90% would pass the benchmark after the second year, but by second grade, over half are failing reading. And we happened to be renting space, so we did a four-year pilot project with them, our first attempt to develop the smart post stuff. And we trained the Minneapolis teachers to work with these transition kindergartens, repeat kindergartners, and they had an all-day format, and so they got 40 minutes of the smart activities. And they ended up reading at between the 82nd and 89th percentile of entering first graders and maintained those gains into second grade. So, again, we are able to show that with some training and mentoring, you can really make a systemic impact for all these kids
right.
without having to buy a new curriculum series or expensive one-on-one intervention, which, given the limited public dollars, it's hard to go beyond that if you have a real expensive program.
Have you looked at even using some of these skills with the older children that to improve their skills as well?
Mr. Chair, we've in these schools, this is all K-6,
sure. Yeah.
And then we've had some schools outside of Minnesota who have replicated these interventions, and actually there are two high schools in Massachusetts, so we've yeah. trained and mentored.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much. President Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really appreciate Bob DeBoer's vision and putting things together like this. It's a very innovative and yet very right on. As I've said in other committees, is in normal situations, regular families, there's all the interaction, the nurturing care that builds all this almost invisibly, and we expect right. it to be there. And with a third of the children in Minnesota being born into what we call poverty, a number of these kids end up in Head Start, and they, for the most part, haven't had this. And I just think of one example of some of the things that they're doing. I could think of an infant on the floor, or maybe a six-month-old, learning how to crawl. And if the parent just sticks it in a chair, sticks it in what do you call those things? The little bouncy seat, and sticks the pacifier in the mouth. Where's the interaction with the environment, the developing of the eye-hand contact, all these things, whereas the baby's on the floor and learning how to wiggle their body because the toy's just out of reach. And if you're a wise parent, you'll leave it out of reach so that they'll get there because they'll learn how to do that body movement and eye-hand coordination and some of these things. And that just expands onto the older ears as they continue to grow. There has to be this constant interaction with the environment to what? Develop the brain, which then leaves the foundation for later learning that we have always taken for granted, and now two things are happening at the same time. We no longer can take it for granted, and we understand the brain development. So we need to make use of it in these innovative programs, and it, along with the academic learning, builds the emotional control and the focused attention that are also foundations to learning. So I really appreciate what he's brought.
Any other questions? Then we'll move the bill to be considered for the Omnibus Bill and the Early Childhood Committee.
The Vice Chair.
Representative Slawick. I have one other member here to ask you a question.
Right.
It's a hard time.
Is it possible to finish out the chairs?
Yeah. Vice Chair. It could have been just the two of us. We're glad to represent the Vice Chair.
Not sure we have enough money for her.
Wow. About that one-time money, Mr. Chair.
President Slaughter, would like to present your bill.
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1839 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee.
Do you have any amendments?
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Okay. All right. Would you like to present the bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair and member, it's and staff and you, all you guys, this is our reader, our last bill here. 1839 was brought to me and talked from working in collaboration with the United Way. So I have Byron Lair here from the United Way. What this does, it's a study to, as you can see, study the implications of restricting the use of state subsidies in center-based child care to centers meeting state quality standards. So with that, I'm going to let Mr. Lair explain it further.
Before you start, I understand you might have an oral amendment that you may have forgotten.
Yeah, you're sitting in my seat, Mr. Chair.
You put me here.
Let's see. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move on line 1.8 to delete by January 1st, 2008, the Commissioner is directed to report back to the chairs of the House and Senate committees having jurisdiction over child care providers for the report.
Okay, insert.
I guess you take away the period, right? So it's a continuation.
Yes.
Okay, so then after the C in parentheses, take out the period and then put and to publish the results no later than January 1st, 2010. The study should include, and then has those points.
Did you get all of that, Mr. McCormick?
I did not. How about one more try?
So after the C in parens, delete the period, and then say and to publish the results no later than January 1st, 2010. The study should include, I think that just to, we'll do the language in a second, just to explain, I think the idea is that not necessarily having the commissioner directed to report back, but that there is the results are published. So that is just a different way of doing it. We think might work better in this case. Oh, yes. Oh, and that takes out the cost. So there's no appropriation needed. So then you delete Section 2.
Did you get it now, Mr. McCormick?
I've got it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Would you like to read it for us, please?
The new sentence shall read from Commissioner of Human Services is directed to study the implications of restricting the use of state subsidies in center-based health care to centers meeting state quality standards under Minnesota Statutes 124D, Part 175, Paragraph C, comma, and to publish the results no later than January 1st, 2010. The study should include, colon, and then we go on with 1, 2, 3, and 4 from the existing bill, and that's the bill.
Thank you.
So, and you have a testifier who'd like to speak to the bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Byron Lair. I'm employed by Greater Twin Cities United Way. Mike over here. And as Representative Slawik said, we had asked for this bill. And we think that there's virtually universal commitment to having our early childhood learning and child care programs delivering quality service. We've seen it in the governor's proposal. We've seen it in proposals both from House and the Senate. And at United Way, we also share this commitment. It's our expectation that the more than $5 million that we spend annually in support of early childhood programs delivers qualities. Our funded agencies will be required to meet the quality rating system standards once they've been developed by MELF and the departments. We believe that at some point in the future, the state of Minnesota should also restrict state funding for early childhood care and learning to providers able to demonstrate that they deliver quality. We also think this is would be a pretty significant achievement, both in providing appropriate early learning to our state's children, as well as ensuring a sufficient infrastructure necessary to support that. This study would provide the state with the kind of information needed to make a decision about whether or not it is feasible to restrict state subsidies in this manner. We've been talking with both the Department of Human Services and the Early Learning Foundation, and the amendment that Representative Slawik offered this evening is a result of some of those discussions. Essentially, what we were told is that the department and MELF working together would be able to do this study together with the contracted quality rating system project that you've heard about a couple of times, even recently, as recently as tonight, and that if we change the requirement from a report to a study, there would not be a fiscal impact, and they would not need an appropriation. And as you just pointed out, money's tight. And we would be just as happy with a report as a formal study costing $48,000, even if part of it was paid by the federal government. So we support the bill and hope that you folks would include that in the committee's final omnibus bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, and I almost talked about this when Representative Winkler asked his question. I mean, when we look at with our priorities, we're closing the achievement gap, which we have with programs like the Representative Lane's bill, and then our second priority was quality. This really gets to the heart of that. And really, when we looked at this large proposal by the Senate, you know, to potentially fund quality programs through scholarships or allowances, does the system have the capacity in which, you know, are the providers out there that we can rate as quality? And we're just, at this point, right now, not sure. And so this kind of gets it in place in terms of working with MELF and getting that all up to speed, because it's really, it's kind of the horse before the cart or the cart before the horse. Or, you know, if you can give a bunch of money to a system, but if it's not ready to take it, you know, potentially could not be well spent, in my opinion. And so we want to make sure we have the quality places kind of identified or set up, or how people become quality, if I'm getting it right. And in terms of, so I think this would be a really good study to do. You know, there was a day here in this legislature where people didn't like studies. And so, but I think that we know with this particular issue, this basically sort of paves the way to someday, you know, doing sort of the Art Wilmot concept of scholarships or allowances when we're ready. And this is part of the piece of, and which I would support maybe someday, but we this is a piece to getting moving us towards that and seeing if it's feasible to move to that kind of a system, or kind of how we do that.
Any questions, member?
Like the military.
Seeing no questions, we'll move the bill to for consideration in the omnibus bill of the Early Childhood Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With no more business for the committee, I think we are adjourned.